Well, good evening, everybody. You're tuned to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com. Welcome, one and all. We've got microphones right from the beginning of the show tonight. I've got lots of interesting stuff lined up for you. After last week's trip with Awakening Albion out amongst the birds and the walk across the country and the countryside, today we're back firmly in amongst the commercial courts with a man known simply as Pete, contesting his council tax. That's the first part of the programme. Hopefully Pete will be able to call in after we've listened to the bit of a chat I recorded with him. And then the latter part of the programme, Pete was lucky enough to get a two-for-one deal from the local magistrates, and they spotted that he also had outstanding payments that they deemed to be made on what was alleged to be him not wearing a seatbelt. So in the later part of the show, we'll get to hear how that went. But before we get onto Pete and stuff, I'll just sort myself out, make sure all of that went all right, play you one more piece of music, and then we'll get into the meat of the show. Welcome, everybody. I'm really looking forward to it. I hope you are too. Well, you're back live with Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com. This is Nick M, and this evening we're going to be listening to Pete talking about his experience recently in a magistrate's court, trying to learn and trying to teach regarding the subject of council tax. The case itself is fairly recent, or the hearing's fairly recent. I think it was 2 or 3 weeks ago now. I'm aware that many of us on TNS, and certainly on the Scottish Sovereigns on the land site, regard it more or less as a point of honour not to go to court unless somebody actually drags us there in chains. And there are many, many reasons for running things that way, as we all know, and it's a very effective method. However, we're also aware that there's many, many different ways of approaching the administrative system in which we find ourselves, and we've covered some of them really in the Dr. Rock show over the last few weeks, but this is our first chance really to see a little bit in detail what's going on in some of these hearings. And I'm very grateful to Pete for giving us the opportunity to hear this stuff, because he definitely has some pretty interesting questions to ask these people. Now, of course, I rather like the Scottish Sovereign's approach to the court, which is to refer to it as a ballroom. And it may well be that some of us, I mean, I wouldn't know what to do in a ballroom myself. Ballroom dancing is definitely not my thing. In fact, any type of dancing at all is a fairly recent acquisition to my skill base. So I personally wouldn't choose to go to a ballroom for a dancing either way, really. But there are obviously some people who like to enter ballrooms and they like to dance. And I think it's very useful that we've got such people around. And one of the things we get a chance to hear whilst talking to Pete is an interesting little discussion on some good reasons for actually going to court, for actually going in there and stating your piece and trying to find out what it is that they have in mind. Because after all, it is at first glance all a little bit of a mystery, isn't it? So it is that Pete goes in there and he deals with the names and the formalities thing just by saying, here we go, we just deal with the names and the formalities, whereas we know that for many of us, that's the bit that we really have to deal with quite hard. So it's good. He's going in there with his straw man and he's trying to find out what's going on. He's got some friends, obviously, that help him out. So he mentions a friend that's with him in the court, a man called Guy, and he also mentions a man called Roger, both of whom I would think are probably pretty familiar to many of the people that are listening to this. So without sort of more word of intro, really, I shall switch over to me and Pete, as we were chatting probably just a couple of weeks or so ago. I'm going to let the first hour or so of it go, which is dealing with the council tax, and then very much hoping that we'll be able to get Pete on to answer any questions you might have. So I'll get him on for a bit of a live chat after this. And towards the end of the show, we'll play the second half of it, which deals with, like I say, a kind of an enforcement hearing, which they followed up with, kind of bit of a hook and a jab job, really. But here he is, Pete and his council tax hearing.
This is Nick M. for Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com. And I'm lucky enough to have Pete with me this evening, and Pete's been contesting the nature and the need to pay of the council tax. He's been trying to find out what the councils here think they're trying to do, and he's been, I guess, trying to educate and trying to learn, and recently His most recent attempts were to be were in court on last Friday, I think it was.
Yeah, a week ago Friday.
Yeah. So we thought we'd see if we could glean anything from him as to kind of what happened. So if you give us some idea as to why you were there and how far it's gone so far, yeah. You know, leading up to this.
Yeah. Well, they actually waited until after the end of the financial year to send me a summons. So this was the whole of 2010 that I didn't pay.
Right, and the summons didn't arrive till the end of
April 2011 or something.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know why they left it so long, but they did.
Oh.
So I got it adjourned because I needed to get some stuff done. But when I went into court, what I wanted to do was I wanted to use the thing about putting them on their oath. And I wanted to go down that whole road, but I did also want to get loads and loads of other stuff. So I didn't really want it to dissolve into mayhem and then stomp out because of their oath or anything.
And you were planning on putting them on their oath rather than asking them whether they were on their oath?
Well, either or both or whatever. Now, the way it turned out was very interesting, but I didn't actually start off with the oath. What I did was went through the usual formalities, names and all that stuff. But what I decided to do was to use something that had been talked about quite a lot, but as far as I know, nobody had ever tried it. Statutory disqualification. And the question was, are any of the magistrates members of a local council? And one of the women said, yes.
So you're looking for a bit of conflict of interest?
Yeah, conflict of interest. Okay. And I said, well, you'll have to stand down. But I was speaking simultaneously with the other magistrates. They said that she had to stand down. And she said she was only a member of some small, I think, youth community council or something. But no, that's council, so she had to go. So they said, well, you don't need to leave the room. The magistrate said that she could sit to one side. So I thought that was a great success. We actually bounced one of the magistrates off the bench.
Don't they technically need to have three to see to you?
Well, I asked them that, and they said no, we can actually just have one if we need to. I'm not sure whether that's true.
That's something that needs looking into.
That needs looking into. But what I think everybody needs to know is that it's a great question, because what if all three of them had been? That would have closed the case down, at least for that day.
Certainly would.
Yeah, but I think it is absolutely essential question, and we've been wondering also whether we can add other questions like, are any of you members of Common Purpose?
Or Freemasons, perhaps.
Or Freemasons. Have any of you ever attended a Common Purpose seminar? And there may be whole lists of questions, but the council one is a killer, because they cannot sit, because there would be direct conflict of interest.
I'm interested.
I then tried the next question we talked about was, do any of the council members agree that one should pay council tax? Or they didn't want to go near that one. Or do any of you pay council tax? Because both of those things also creates conflict of interest as well.
Very interesting questions.
Yeah, they're not mine. It was a guy that actually came up with all of that thing.
Right.
But the thing is that these are very interesting questions because how can you get a fair hearing if you're being heard by somebody that disagrees with what you're doing?
You are essentially trying to establish the details of the jurisdiction, aren't you?
Yeah.
Not just whether it's civil or criminal, but the land in which you're operating.
Yeah.
And they clearly were very wary of that by the sound of it.
Yeah.
So presumably you'll be poking them a bit harder next time you see them on...
Yeah, and I would urge everybody to at least use the council one. The conflict of interest if any of them are members of councils.
Yes.
But then further questions, definitely.
Yeah. So the other thing, of course, is that's an interesting way for them to start, because they're already a bit on the back foot,
definitely,
aren't they, by
yeah.
asking them things they're not prepared to answer.
Yeah, we definitely put them on the back foot with that one.
So where did you go after that?
Then I went on to the oath, and I asked them, the two remaining, the two gentlemen that were left, I asked them if they were on their oath, and there was a bit of argy-bargy about it, but eventually they did both say yes, they were on their oath. So that means that they had acknowledged that we were in a common law jurisdiction. But then of course every single action that happened after that, they were back in statute land. They were just acting as the administrative or mercantile or whatever type of court
yeah.
we all we all know that it is. So. But they did actually say yes. And I didn't challenge them on that right on the spot, but it came out afterwards.
It did, yeah.
Because the next thing I moved on to was the Statutory Declarations Act. Now, this is an absolute great one. There's one whole page in Archbold's criminal pleadings,
yeah,
which explains that Section 13 and Section 7 of the Statutory Declarations Act, 1835, which lays out both of the ways in which magistrates and judges can be prosecuted for either refusing to take or administering an unlawful oath. Section 13 deals with the administration of an unlawful oath. Section 7 is the section which says that oaths are still to be taken, and I recommend everybody to read those sections and become very, very aware of it. But there's another piece of the Statutory Declarations Act that we'll talk about a bit later on, which is another part altogether, which came as a gift out of the blue, but we'll talk about that later.
These first two bits sound pretty useful,
yeah,
because of course the guy essentially was, by saying yes we're on our oath, and then by behaving not as your kind of protector and helper, is effectively is a false oath, isn't it?
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah, okay.
Because quite simply, the magistrates and judges' oath is a common law oath. They swear to do right by all manner of people without
fear or favour,
ill will, or etc. etc.
Yeah.
And they swear to uphold her Majesty's sovereign queen.
Yeah, and the laws.
And they swear to uphold the laws of the realm. Well, the laws of the realm are not statute; they are common law.
Yes.
So actually, either way round, they're imposters. If they do take their oath, then they are sitting in an administrative court with a common law oath.
Yeah.
Now, a common law oath does not swear them to uphold the laws of commerce. It binds them to uphold the laws of the realm,
yes,
which is for the protection of the people.
Yeah.
But if they refuse to take their oath, then they're just refusing point blank to be under oath anyway.
And there's no authority in the court.
So they have no authority, they have no jurisdiction. But the Section 13, the one we're administering an unlawful oath, is a real interesting one. Because when you read further down the page in Archbold's, Archbold's contains, in every section they have a model indictment. And so further down the page, it says that if the magistrates are administering an unlawful oath, they can be charged and prosecuted for the administration of an unlawful oath. They can go to prison for it. And not only that, it goes even further. It's prima facie, which means that the only thing you have to prove is that they were there on the day. You don't have to prove intent or anything.
Wow.
It's just the fact that they're there doing it is enough to convict. So what I did was I read out the whole page, and I got through Section 13, I got through Section 7, but when I moved on to the indictment, the clerk of the court started squabbling.
The clerk of the court being probably one of the people in there who really knows his stuff.
Yeah, that's right. And he wasn't the most pleasant clerk of the court, if there is any,
very
ever any such thing as a pleasant.
Interesting to see where he stepped in, to see how far he let you get with it all.
Right, unfortunately we couldn't get it onto tape, so... there was a glitch in that, but
shame.
But so basically, both the clerk and the bench were shouting me down when I was trying to read out the indictment part of the page. But I certainly got through the two sections,
and really?
Section 13, Section 7. And so what I told the magistrates was, look, you have said that you are on your oath, which means that we are in the common law jurisdiction. So you are therefore administering an unlawful oath, because this is not a common law hearing. And they said, oh, that's just your opinion, that's your opinion. And I was going, but no, this is from Archbold's criminal pleadings, this is the law, that's just your opinion, that's just your opinion.
It's Archbold's opinion.
No, that's my opinion.
Yeah.
They were shouting at me that's my opinion. And I was reading out...
Archbold's, it's Archbold's opinion.
It's a flipping
You're
law book.
Simply the mouthpiece.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So we couldn't actually get them to stand down over that one, because they just kept on saying that that was my opinion. And
I'm very interested by the fact that the clerk of the court let you get through those two bits, but it was the indictment bit of it that he wasn't happy on having read out.
I had to do a lot of shouting down to get anything read out.
Did you?
Yeah, a bit earlier on I read out the diplock. I forgot to mention that.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first thing I read out was the statutory disqualification, and then I read out the diplock ruling from 1974, which absolutely everybody should have a copy of.
Yeah.
I have it printed out big so that I could read it out clearly.
Yeah.
And they shouted down a little bit at the beginning of that, had to start again, but I got right through the whole thing, and they shut up for that. And I just had to do a lot of shouting down to get these things read out.
I find that, you see, the thing is, some of the court cases I've heard, you know, on the radio have been really well-mannered, and I feel myself I don't like interrupting other people. Did you not find it difficult to keep your level with being interrupted by them?
I was just not prepared to back down.
Fair enough. I mean, it's pretty uncivilised behaviour, though, isn't it?
But of course it is. But you see, the thing is that according to them, this isn't the way that cases are supposed to run.
Well, you're not even supposed to be in there talking, are you, really?
No, I mean, I went in there just determined to be the maverick and to just get said what I wanted to say.
And were you in there on your own, or did you have sort of moral support?
No, I had a guy with me as a Mackenzie friend.
Right, and can talk, can you, whilst this is going on?
Well, you can confirm it.
Okay.
But you see, that what the clerk of the court says, he gave Guy the spiel about being Mackenzie friend. He didn't realise who he was dealing with. And he said, of course, he said, you're allowed to confer quietly. He said, but of course you're not allowed to speak. And Guy said, okay. So it wasn't very long before Guy was talking, and the clerk was telling him to shut up. And I think there was one very brief occasion when somebody said something about contempt of court if you didn't shut up.
Yeah.
But of course, there is no shutting Guy up.
No.
So Guy just continued to defy them when it came to speaking, and he's just completely outspoken. So it's really ace. I mean, we did confer quietly a lot,
yeah.
But he went right for it, and the clerk was constantly telling him to shut up, and he was constantly arguing back. But apart from that one brief moment, there was never any question of them trying to threaten me with contempt of court.
Which is good.
And I was really overstepping the mark.
And it is a risk, isn't it?
It is
a risk, although do we not know from, is it Diplock or Archbold that points out that you can't have contempt of court when a judge is sitting alone, i.e. without a jury?
I think we do know. We do know that. But
it doesn't seem to apply, again, because I know people, you definitely are running a risk of that, aren't you?
Yeah,
you're running a risk of doing 6 or maybe 12 months.
Yeah, that's right. But of course, if they tried that, we would have fired Diplock straight back at them because they're actually administering an unlawful oath anyway. Yeah.
Also, they apparently do have to get you up. I hear they have to get you up before sundown on the same day, and they have to have your signature sometime between when they seize you and when they get you back up again.
Oh, is that right?
So if you've not signed it, they can't do you. Well, apparently,
I wouldn't be signing anything.
No, exactly.
Yeah, so basically I had three folders that I carried into court. I carried like a council tax one with all my council tax stuff in.
Yeah.
I had another one for the seatbelt thing, which I knew that they were going to bring up from months and months ago.
What's the seatbelt?
This non-payment of a fine for a fixed penalty.
Right, yeah.
I'll talk about that later.
Yeah, yeah. You're doing all your cases all in one go here.
Well, not my choice. They brought it up.
And they bring you all in at once?
Well,
the seatbelt thing and the council tax thing.
No, I had three folders.
Yeah, okay.
One was full of council tax documents, full of seatbelt documents, and the other one was just the opening folder. And everything I've talked about so far, we were still in the opening folder.
Right.
This was the...
Setting the scene.
Yeah, challenge the court, basically. Mm.
So where did you go next?
I think that was about the end of... The opening one. I mean, this was took at least half an hour, if not more.
Mostly because they were interrupting you.
Yeah, interrupting, but there was loads of material.
Yeah.
There was statutory disqualification. Mm. There was all the statutory declaration stuff, which is actually a very big thing.
Mm.
Because they can be prosecuted for it. I don't know if anybody's ever going to be able to nail them on it. Somebody might want to focus on it.
Yeah.
But it's really worth reading that whole section of Archbold's.
Yeah.
Because it completely nails the whole question of the legality or otherwise of the oath that they're on,
yeah.
and the the sanctions against them if they breach those requirements.
And you have a physical copy of that, or can you download it as well, presumably, or do you have to get a...
Actually, I think you'd need to have an online copy of Archibald's to get that full thing. Yeah. You can get the Statutory Declarations Act, that's just online.
Yeah, all the acts are online, aren't they?
Yeah, but to get the actual indictment, you'd need to photocopy it from the book.
Right.
And I actually typed the whole thing up.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have a copy and paste on computer.
It'd probably be quite good to try and make those documents available somehow, wouldn't it? Would you be prepared to post them up where people can get at them?
Yeah.
Because we could put them up on TNS if nowhere else. Because, you know, we obviously like to have things up there that people can use and investigate.
Yeah, definitely. I can do it as a Word document.
Be absolutely brilliant. And I've also been thinking, just to go off the subject a little bit, we've been thinking here that we were going to produce some little cards that have got things like a definition of a breach of the peace on it.
Yeah.
On one card, there'd be a policeman's oath on another card. You know, a load of things that you can have in your breast pocket.
Right.
So that some key things are there for you to look at frequently or when you need them.
Yeah.
And perhaps some of this stuff would fall into that category.
Yeah, it could well do, yeah.
Could, you know, critical stuff. So you obviously created quite a stir then. They probably weren't expecting any of this.
Well, they might have been expecting it because quite separate from this, I'd delivered a load of affidavits to the council offices in my area. And three affidavits. There was an affidavit, but these were all about Article 61 of Magna Carta.
Okay.
Because I wanted to put the council on notice that they actually have no authority anyway.
Yeah.
But they have no authority in a separate way from most of the ways that we've been talking about.
Okay, so what was the basic... the thrust of... 61, Article 61.
Article 61, it's a little bit of a deviation from the actual case itself, but we can talk about it.
You know, if you're using it, it obviously was of use to you.
Well, I didn't actually use it in the case, but...
It was in the affidavits.
But I did have a letter from the council, council tax manager, that he'd sent a copy to the court. Now, he obviously thought that I was going to base my case on this, because I squeezed them all in before the case actually happened.
Right.
And I did actually at one time imagine that it might have been useful in the case, but then I thought about it and thought, well, actually not.
Why were there several affidavits on this subject rather than just one?
It's one affidavit, a notice of default and a final notice.
Okay, cool, yeah, I see.
Now, and unfortunately I haven't got the copies here with me, but again, I can post them, I need to get permission from the fellow that wrote them.
Not a problem.
Now, the first one is basically informing the public servant, whoever they are, that Article 61 of Magna Carta is the article which makes it lawful to engage in lawful rebellion.
Right.
Because in 1215 King John was forced to sign this whole... Magna Carta, which is in fact a peace treaty, which was supposed to create peace between himself and the barons specifically, although at Runnymede when it was signed there were thousands and thousands of people, free men, commoners, all sorts of people, and of course there was also the Forest Charter that I think was signed 2 years afterwards or something, which enshrined all of the rights of the foresters like wood gathering and animal grazing and all sorts of things. But Article 61 is the last but one article in Magna Carta, and what it says is that the King promises to abide by all of the rights and agreements in the previous articles of the Charter. If he should breach them, the barons are permitted to get together a committee of 24, from which they'll select a group of four, who will then petition the King with the list of grievances. And the King has 40 days to put them right and make reparations. And if he doesn't do so within 40 days, then the barons declare that they and the population are allowed to distrain upon the King's goods and chattels.
I remember that was something, that was one of the Birkenhead and invade the castles. And
that's
That was one of the driving forces behind the Birkenhead event, wasn't
that's
it?
That's it.
Yeah.
Now, under Article 61, the only things that are immune from distraint by the people is the King's life, the life of the Queen and their heirs. Everything else is liable to be taken in reparation for those breaches of the Charter that the king is deemed to have made.
Yeah.
And then it goes on to say something like, as soon as reparations have been made, then we will all be subject to the king again. But until such time, we are in the state of lawful rebellion. Mm. It doesn't use those words, but that's what
yeah.
it means.
Yeah.
And it also says a couple of other things. It says that the barons are permitted to get anybody in the country to sign up to be part of the crew that seizes the castles and lands, etc.
Yeah.
But it also says that the barons can require people to as well.
Oblige.
Yeah. Yeah, so
it's very, a duty.
Yeah, a duty to distrain the monarch of his goods and chattels because he's breached the charter.
It presumably makes it more or less unlawful for you to hand over cash to them as well.
Yeah.
To support them in any way.
Well, I'd say so. Mm. But so then what happened is that in 2001, this actually happened.
Well, what, we got a party of barons together yeah. to go and see yeah. Mrs. Quinn.
Mrs. Yeah. Queen, yeah. yeah. So what happened apparently is that hundreds of thousands of people had written to the Queen postcards asking her not to sign the Treaty of Nice, which was one of those treaties that put us under European
yeah.
jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And she ignored it. And so a committee of the barons, before she signed it, a committee of from the House of Lords, I think it was 60-odd of them, mm-hmm. 69 was it?
Yeah.
They selected a committee of 24, who selected a committee of 4, who petitioned the Queen on 7th of March, was it? It was in the Telegraph, there was an article. And they petitioned the Queen, asking her not to sign the Treaty of Nice. So she went ahead and signed it, and didn't get back to them within the 40 days, so they declared a state of lawful rebellion as of that date in 2001.
Yeah.
And we're still in it.
Yeah.
So that's a brief history of
yeah.
of how this came about. So I sent the affidavit to the head of the council tax informing him of all this stuff.
Okay.
And then the second notice, the notice of default after the
after here's another 10 days or
yeah,
whatever
it was, yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. It's fairly short, I think 7 days
yes.
or something.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to squeeze it into this
yeah.
1 month period. The second document gives much, much more information. And one of the things that the second document says is that you cannot rely on statute to hide behind, because Magna Carta is not a statute. It's a contract signed between the people and the king. It's a peace treaty. And any breach of a peace treaty returns the country to the internecine strife that was in place before the treaty was signed, which created the peace.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting point. And the second point that he made about statute is that Magna Carta is a statute, but it was signed into statute in 1294.
So
by Edward the First, I believe.
Okay, so later on.
Yeah, later on. But what the default notice says is that a statute cannot undo a contract, a peace treaty. All it can do is either add things or take things away, and in this case, it took lots of things away.
Yeah,
but it cannot change the original document. So just because the statute of 1297, I think it
yeah,
was, just because that statute has changed the original Magna Carta,
yeah.
it doesn't change the original Magna Carta. Mm. All it is a statute that stands there as well.
Yeah.
But it doesn't affect the original document.
Yeah. It's like you can put a clause into a contract saying that you can vary the terms and conditions, but the very clause itself is not enforceable.
No, that's void.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Even as it was written.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and there was another interesting.
So that's effectively given them a whole different macro story to dwell on, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Your intro stuff's pretty personal, pretty here, pretty 20th century.
Yeah.
And this is a whole back projection.
That's right. Well, it runs alongside.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons for delivering these documents to the council is to point out one absolutely crucial thing. Is once the Queen is defaulted on the Baron's petition, she then loses her sovereignty.
Mm.
because...
Well, she signed it away anyway.
Yeah.
With the Lisbon, with the Nice Treaty, which is the problem, isn't it, essentially?
Well, she did, but viewing it from an internal British constitution point of view...
Yeah.
She's been put on notice by the barons, according to the law, yeah. which is Magna Carta.
Yeah.
But she hasn't responded. So she loses authority
on
that 40th day.
Yeah, she does, yeah.
She's lost authority. Because she has sworn an oath, coronation oath, she has sworn to serve the people. Mm. All of the public servants beneath her have sworn an oath to the sovereign to do the same thing.
So their authority goes to...
Their authority goes instantaneously. And what the guy that wrote the document came up with this wonderful phrase, when the servant loses power... The servant of the servant loses power. So that means that every single public servant in Britain since that date of 2001 has not had authority. They lose the power of signature.
Well, I really hadn't spotted that, because as you know, I understand the basis of this, but I haven't made that logical leap.
That's right. Mm. That's right. Well, I actually hadn't as well. It wasn't until I was given these documents. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And the incisiveness and the insight in them is wonderful. Mm. So I'll ask the author if it's okay to publish them.
It'd be great.
They'll be anonymised, of course.
Yeah, I think we'll probably republish at the same time. I'd like to republish the documents you were handing out at Birkenhead, because I haven't been able to find them on the net. I've got copies of them, so I'll type all those back in again.
Oh, right, yeah. Once again, I'll have to get on to Roger about that.
Because they've got quite a lot of stuff about what you're talking
about
they have. As well. And you could tell somebody had spent a lot of time making them right. So
that's right.
I could give you my copies before you go, actually, so you can show them to Roger then, and perhaps we can find the original files.
That'd be brilliant, yeah.
Because it's all pertinent, I think.
Yeah, actually, you'd need a computer file for them, wouldn't you?
Yes, yeah. It's a lot easier that way if we can.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if nothing else, that business as to the level of, if you like, the decline or the loss of authority is, of course, extremely helpful to some people who are still juggling with the idea of their own sovereignty.
That's right.
Of themselves entering a world of unlimited liability and personal responsibility.
Yeah.
If you realise that all other authority has been voided, effectively, then it becomes even more essential to step in and start doing the job.
Now, the interesting thing is that the authority goes through the Queen. Because, once again, the author of these documents said that he thought Magna Carta's great, but if it was up to him, he would actually have the oath sworn to the people, not to the sovereign.
Yeah.
Because why should it go through an intermediary, some third party?
Depends what they're setting up, that does.
Yeah. Yeah, but if you kept Magna Carta in its exact form, but instead of swearing, the allegiance going to the Queen, then the allegiance goes to the people, then public servants would be directly... servants of the people, not servants of the Queen, and
there
then
is a servant of the people.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. It's very, very interesting because as soon as you start talking about this, you start to get a real taste of the fact that these people, right up to the monarch, are actually public servants.
Yeah,
then they're not there to lord it.
No.
But
very easy to forget that.
Human ego being what it is, it's not difficult to forget it.
Yeah.
But the real truth of it and the actual structure of our constitution, the structure of the application of law to society is on the basis of public service.
Yeah.
It's not on the basis of rule.
No. Public service and our consent.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a distraction from the court case, but it is interesting because just before I went to court, I think on the Thursday I had a letter from the council tax manager. It says, I acknowledge receipt of your notice. I have forwarded a copy to the court. What on earth has he done that for? What a weird letter.
Yeah.
As though it was really important. He obviously thought I was going to build some enormous case around it. Perhaps he's nervous, I don't know.
I suppose they don't know, do they?
No.
They're having to second guess all the time. That is quite an interesting response, though.
Yeah.
Is to forward it to the court. So it was on, basically, in your file with them, that affidavit.
Yeah, so the bench may well have been waiting for something to happen, or they'd been forewarned.
That's quite a clever idea as well. I know that when I sent in my conditional agreements, I deliberately nicked one straight off the internet and didn't change anything so they could write telling me that I'd just got something straight off the internet and should get a solicitor, and then I sent them one letting them know what I knew.
Yeah.
It's more fun that way, isn't it? So what happened next in the court then?
Well, next in the court, we moved on to the actual juice of the council tax stuff itself, which was kind of, it was very bitty. The prosecutor made his speech and da-da-da-da-da. And then they got this poor fellow up. He's the council tax enforcement officer. Who obviously knows absolutely nothing about anything, and I cross-examined him, and I really put him on the spot a couple of times. One particular bit that was interesting, I asked him if he was authorised to make a legal determination, because I said, you are the enforcement officer, you obviously operate according to some sort of code of law.
Yeah.
But are you allowed to make a legal determination? And he gave this big fudge of an answer. And I said, no, with respect, I would like a yes or no answer. Are you authorised to make a legal determination? And he fudged again, and the clerk of the court started chipping in, which he was doing constantly anyway. And I said to the clerk, I said, look, I said, I've asked him a very simple question, and I want a straight answer, yes or no. And da-da-da went on and on and on. And he was fudging and fudging. And eventually, I actually made him say no.
Yeah.
So guy said, well, thank you very much. And I said, thank you very much.
Yeah.
So, but he looked really sheepish, because he'd actually been, because I tend to be a little bit like a terrier with these small, significant points.
Yeah.
But I wasn't prepared to let the clerk or anybody else force the question to be deviated.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kept on and on. Yeah. Are you authorised to make a legal determination? Eventually he said no, he knew he was cornered. Mm-hmm. And
said no in the first place.
Yeah,
he just
said no, but he obviously thought it was leading somewhere absolutely dreadful, and he was going to go down some hole.
Which is kind of good, isn't it? Because you've kind of got the wind up them. They just don't know what you're doing.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
And then I was dead lucky. I got, by circuitous route, I actually got a photocopy of a couple of pages of the manual that the council tax enforcement people use. Again, I can get the name of it. I tried to get it from the library, but it's very, very rare. Apparently,
you do surprise me.
Yeah. apparently, there is a copy in the British Library in Euston Road in London.
Right.
So if anybody wants to take the trouble...
Is it a big document, this?
It's probably quite big, but I just had two pages. But they're actually very significant pages.
Right.
Because it's all about council tax enforcement. And there's a couple of paragraphs about this is very interesting. I think people should really think about this particular aspect of it.
Yeah.
Because there's some really interesting legal and lawful questions that arise. It's got a paragraph that's headed something about proof of liability or liability orders, proof of evidence or something.
Okay.
And in there, it actually says the thing which Roger Hayes made a big deal of in his case, which is when the person doesn't pay, the council sends a complaint to the justices, and the justices issue a summons, which actually they don't.
No. I think it's generally accepted, isn't it, that the council hire rooms in the court and issue the papers themselves.
Yeah. So I quizzed this guy on this particular bunch of stuff, which loads of us talked about incessantly.
Yeah.
And so I said to him, I said, just how does this system work? Because I said, in Stone's Justice's manual, which I also had copies of, it actually says that when a complaint is made to the justices, the justices or the justice's clerk are required to apply their mind to consider whether it is appropriate to issue a summons. So I said to him, when, as it says in your manual, that you make complaints to the justices, when you make that complaint to the justices, are you sure that the justices apply their mind to whether a summons ought to be issued? Like, do they go through all the details of the case? Do they make inquiries, etc., etc., etc.? He couldn't really deal with that.
Independent witnesses supported by affidavits from their own personal knowledge.
Yeah.
All of that.
Yeah. But the thing is that he really didn't have any answers to that. Mm. So they went through this whole spiel of explaining to me how that actually works. And then they said the name of the justice's clerk that does all this work. And...
Well, shame you didn't get all that on tape.
Yeah, it's a great shame because there's loads and loads of detail and I can't actually remember it all.
That's the way it goes, isn't it?
But I did give him a real good quizzing over that, and I also gave him a good quizzing over how they actually do the summonses.
Yes.
But nothing really incriminating came out of it. They either fudged it or it's that one rare counsel that does do it in a reasonable way.
Yeah.
But what he did tell me is that they do send a whole list to the justices, and then the justices send back an authorisation to them to actually print the summonses. So he didn't deny that the council prints the summonses.
Right.
But it sounded they did make out some sort of an answer which sounded a lot more reasonable than a lot of the other stories that I'd heard.
Yeah.
But I didn't think it was a major point to really go on because I didn't actually want to build a case.
You're seeking information, yeah, aren't you, really?
Yeah, it was as much seeking information.
Yeah.
And I told them on quite a number of occasions that there'll probably be a judicial review on yeah. process.
Yeah. That's something perhaps we can talk about, the nature of judicial review a little bit further, because this game I know is crucial.
Yeah, but that's not something I know very much about.
No, that's all right. I'll get to Rusty on that one,
because yeah.
I know it's another of his big tools.
Yeah, he knows a lot yeah. about that already.
Well, as soon as I see him online, I'll give him a ring, we'll get him on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you can run into Earth, you'll be a better man than I.
I know, indeed. Keeping up with him is a little difficult. There you go.
But I also gave him a hard time on another bit out of the same manual, because it's got two case histories in there. And these case histories, they say absolutely conclusively that in these couple of cases, one was from the 60s and one was from the 80s, it actually said that the courts had agreed that the burden of proof definitely rests with the defendant, not with the counsel.
Really?
So the burden of proof requires that the defendant shows that they're not liable, rather than the council having to prove that they are liable.
Is that
now,
right? That's quite surprising, isn't it?
That breaches right to silence. It breaches innocent till proved guilty, everything.
So where was this information?
It's in this enforcement manual.
No, enforcement manual, right.
Yeah, the council...
But for a moment I thought it was in one of these sort of, you know, authoritative texts. I see. So, yeah. Oh, that's quite interesting.
Yes.
So it's instructing them to break the law.
Yeah.
It's gotta
be. But law has become so broken anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no worse than a fixed penalty, really, in their eyes.
Mm.
That the person is the burden of proof has shifted to the ratepayer. I mean,
it's
outrageous.
It is outrageous because it's definitely not the case.
Yeah,
you know, it's
not
the plaintiff's business to prove.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then following on from that, a little while later, I mean, I was really primed for this because I didn't like the word defendant in this manual anyway.
No.
Because we aren't defendants.
No.
Because this is actually a civil case that's being heard in the magistrate's court, which is essentially a criminal court. But they're describing us as defendants.
Yeah.
They're describing the counsel as applicant.
Mm. And the defendant is another of, because this is something, again, I realised fairly recently, is that your straw man isn't just your name. Your straw man is a driver, your straw man is a defendant, your straw man is an occupier, your straw man has an address. All of these things are aspects of this sort of straw man thing.
Yeah. So, just a few minutes after that, in some maybe unrelated discussion, the clerk of the court called me defendant.
Oh.
And I said, I beg your pardon.
That's an allegation, mate.
Yeah.
Surely.
Well, I said, what are you talking about, defendant? There's no... I'm not here because of some offence, alleged or otherwise.
Yeah. And it's a hearing you're in, isn't it?
A hearing?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a trial.
No.
So, So he started to try to change the subject, we'll move on. And I said, no. No, I said, we're not moving on. You called me a defendant.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Is that your testimony? Dear me, yeah.
He didn't like that at all. So eventually I shouted at him a bit about it. But it was as much to put him in his place as to get any real juice out of it, because he wouldn't apologise.
It's completely correct. I think it's the same thing as if they try to get away with court, you know, by your name when you're trying to not do the name thing with them.
That's right.
It really is important not to let them put these labels on you, because
that's right.
The law is operational law. It operates on nouns, and if you let them get away with using the wrong ones, then they're on their way to having you, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this went on and on for a bit, but it was... I was more interested in gathering information than actually succeeding, because I don't think anybody ever stops them signing a liability order. I've never heard of it.
No. I think it's why so many people just slip to the return to sender, because after the initial kind of like, you know, look, write to me, tell me that this isn't true, and you fairly soon realise that all you're getting is what I describe as a load of different shaped forms, all of which say give us the money.
Yeah, that's right.
And so what's the point?
Yeah.
You know, in trying to communicate and turning up in the course and all of that, you might as well just keep going return to sender, no contract.
Well, the reason for going to court is that every single time we go in there and do this to them, they lose a little bit of their power.
Yeah.
And I think the more of us that do it, even though it creates problems down the line with bailiffs or bankruptcies or whatever, but somehow or another, there's two reasons. First is to get confidence in handling a court case, to get knowledge, lose fear, but also to keep on and on and on putting them on notice that there is loads of people out here that aren't standing for it anymore, and just so that they know, so hopefully the courts would get swamped with them. I don't know if they ever will, but.
Well, it all takes a lot of time and effort and money, doesn't it?
Mm.
And the thing that is particularly striking me about your story is that it's like a fire to them. They really are responding quite randomly.
Yeah.
They feel they have to respond quickly to things that they don't fully understand.
That's right.
And that has got to be helpful to us by and large as well, because that often reveals things that you otherwise wouldn't have found out.
Yeah. I mean, I know there's a lot of people that think that the thing to do is to stand your ground with the oath and try to get them to leave the court.
Yeah.
But if you do that, it's great. It's a great success. But usually they'll sign the liability order behind your back when you've gone anyway.
Yeah.
But I think that if we keep them going for a long time, we actually learn a lot.
Yes.
And we really do learn a lot.
Yeah. And because we're starting to play, we do really need to learn the rules as they can be made to reveal themselves.
Yeah.
So some of the rules are written down and you're taking them in with you and trying to use them.
Yeah.
But a lot of the rules are either not written down or we haven't come across them yet. And so the best way of discovering the rules is to find out how they're manifesting in the field of play.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So mostly you were actually in there gathering information today. Although, let's make no bones about it, you were risking doing time for contempt.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I've been in enough cases now that contempt thing, you don't hear it very often. I don't know if they've dropped doing it or what.
Because technically, I think if they were challenged on it, there's loads of ways that people would start getting around that as well. Perhaps they realise that. And perhaps they've realised that the better thing to do for them to do is to try and stay on the mark here.
Yeah.
Because they must be as keen to try and work some sort of resolution as well. I'd be very interesting to know what's going on in the judges' clubs and stuff, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'd love to know, because there's no way of telling what they think is happening.
No.
And I get the impression that they haven't come up with a strategy yet.
I'm not sure even, because, you know, I talk a lot about the fact that we talk the way we're talking now, but also at the festivals we go to now, places like, you know, the Truth Juice Gathering, that I know you were at, and the Sunrise Celebration, there are masses of us meeting and talking about our experiences and serving notices and going to court and all of that.
Yeah.
And we've got our radio shows and our chat rooms and all of that, and I'm not sure yet, that there's any kind of communication at all on the other side
No.
as to what's being used And then, you know, we've got access to what's happening in Australia and America and all of that.
Yeah.
So.
And we're interested in finding out as well.
Yeah.
Because I think it may be worth mentioning at this stage that my experience of, because I've been to lots of other people's court cases, but this is, it's the first meaningful one of mine that I've done much talking in. The impression I get is that they cannot deal with a truly intellectual discussion.
No.
That the level of intellect that I've come across in the Free Man and Lawful Rebellion movement is way ahead of anything you hear in the courts.
Yeah.
We've had some really fascinating discussions with clerks of the court when the judges have been retired or the magistrates have gone out to think of something, or if there's been a break to arrange an adjourned case time or something, and then we've basically given the clerks a hard time and quizzed them, but intellectually they seem incapable of engaging with a common law concept. Because they just say, oh, statute is the law. In fact, this guy in Birkenhead, he's outrageous. He said, no, law is statute. Mm. And we were going, what? But we live in a common law jurisdiction. He didn't seem capable.
No.
Of even embracing the concept.
No, I'm told that first year law students know about the legal fiction, but they, because of the way they're taught about it, they see it as a completely different thing. You know, we tend to start looking at things like the legal fiction and all these other things once our backs are against the wall, because we've got to start looking at them.
That's right.
And of course, they're choosing to go to law school. They're looking forward to getting a whole lot of money for doing what they're doing and being better than everybody else. So they don't see it. They literally don't see it the same we do. It is literally like they're living on the other side of the looking glass.
Yeah.
Very interesting indeed, because I know that some of the Scottish sovereigns, they're actually studying law, obviously with people who are studying law with the other idea in mind.
Yeah.
And I've been particularly interested by some of the comments in the chat box as to how these people are relating to each other, because they're effectively learning two different facets of the same truth.
Yeah.
And their own consciousnesses, our side seems to be able to see both, if you like. Other side seems only be able to see, you know, the hard surface of the mirror.
That is very interesting, yeah. Yeah. Because almost everybody that I speak to has no problem in understanding that we were born here as innocent human beings. Mm. The cosmos didn't intend us to become enslaved. That wasn't the reason why we were born here. We've become enslaved because there are some people out there that want to do it to us.
Yeah.
For whatever reasons, mate, it's natural.
And it is codependent as well, because it relies on our cooperation.
Yeah.
We're part of it too.
That's right.
Amazingly enough.
That's right. But the simplest concept is that, well, you make a demand on me, that's fine, you're free to do that. But in law, if you want to enforce that demand, you have to prove your claim.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I really don't have a problem with that.
No, I don't think anybody does. We're all genuinely saying, you know, we're not saying we're not going to pay. We're saying that the claim does need to be documented and verified.
Yeah, and you
because we don't think it's a verifiable claim.
That's right.
And the fact that they are failing solidly and persistently to document and verify almost any of their claims at all does suggest still that we're onto a good one.
That's right. And but when it comes to this is what I was meaning when before we were talking about the lack of remedy.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a situation where a demand is being made on you, and the structure of law that provides for somebody to think that they're authorised to make that demand, if the structure of law that has created their authority to demand it, if it does not contain some kind of avenue of argument that the demandee can come up and say, well, but hang about a minute, I don't actually think that that's right, and wishes to make a debate about it in law so that some wise judge or some jury can listen to the evidence and say, well, yes, actually, you have a very good point, da 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 da, and then requires the other side to make their argument for their claim. The structure of statute and the fact that statute insists that it has more power than the common law avenues of debate in law. The people that are creating and enforcing the statutes appear to have no way of understanding that there's this vital piece missing from their set of rules.
And one of the things that's missing, of course, is that it's just set up and set up and set up, 65,000 statutes, whatever it is, you stand no chance. Whereas the real beauty of the common law is that it's constantly, everything that happens that's worthy of note is put up in front of a dozen or so people who can talk about it and say, well, how are we as a society going to think about that at this time?
Yeah.
And they can come to a conclusion. And if the same thing happens 10 or 20 years down the line, then a different 12 people are going to come up and look at it in the context of that age. It's a new generation. 20 years have passed.
Yeah.
Perhaps we don't think the same thing about it. And perhaps we're going to make a slightly different decision.
Yeah.
And then those set the precedents which become the law until a jury comes up with a different precedent.
That's right. Yeah.
And there is none of that inspection and government and the slight changing and tweaking of things.
Yeah.
It's just, we're going to paint two yellow lines on the ground, and if you put your vehicle on them, then you owe us 60 quid.
That's right.
And what's more, when we write another £50 weight of this legislation, we're going to leave the thousands of pounds of other weight of other legislation on the books.
Yeah.
So there will just be more and more and more and more of it. Whereas the common law, what the juries are expected to understand and look into, is you shall cause nobody any harm, cause nobody any loss, not use mischief in your contract, and cause no breach of the peace.
Yeah.
Easy to remember.
Yeah.
So.
Yes, very, very interesting. It's this absence of remedy that's actually bugging me more and more and more. Because
specifically in the council tax thing, where they are deeming you to be liable.
Yes, that's right.
From the word go, which is why they say there's no need for a contract. But like you say, if you are deemed to be liable and there's no need for a contract, why is there a need for a court case?
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm,
yeah.
A good point.
Yeah, because we didn't mention that, did we?
No.
Just to put it on the record, that before I ever sent them a conditional offer, I actually sent a letter to the council tax manager with various questions about different types of contracts. But the crucial question, I thought the one that I really wanted answered and still haven't had it answered, is that I said, if the council finds it necessary to go to a court to gain a liability order, does that mean that the person, up until the point when the liability order is signed, that person is not liable? And of course he didn't answer that. He fudged an answer about liability.
I presume you'll lean on that one a bit, will you?
Yeah, well, if I ever get to talk to him, I don't know if he'll ever agree to have a meeting, but I actually want an answer to that question.
Mm, yeah.
Because it contains a whole chunk of doublethink that why would you need a court case?
Yeah.
Because if you deem the person liable, it says in the statute somewhere that they decide that you're liable. I don't know quite how it works.
It's pretty astonishing that as well, I find.
It does say it in the statute.
Amazing.
Chance
to be stamped.
So if you are deemed liable, then why don't they just send the bailiffs around without a liability order? Why do they have to?
Yeah.
This is really puzzling me.
It's actually an unnecessary step, because they're obviously heading straight towards the bailiffs and selling the debt on anyway. It does seem strange to me as well.
Yeah.
It does.
But I suspect that even though he's told me on two occasions that they don't need a contract, I suspect that that court case somehow constitutes a contract, and I can't figure out how they do it. But I think it does, and like we were saying before, the key to understanding it, I think, might lie in the fact that if you don't go to court, they get their liability order anyway, and they get it by acquiescence because you didn't go.
Yeah. The return to sender is pointing out to them that you have no reason to go,
that's
and of course under civil law you are not obliged to go.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you can. You're free to not go if you want to. But it's what happens if you don't go.
Yeah.
It's that they get their liability order, but they get it because you didn't go.
I think it's a very interesting avenue of investigation. That I'll try and remember that, because it's quite a subtle point you're making, and we'll talk to people as we run into them.
Well, it's tangling my brain, I have to say.
We're off to the Secret Garden Party in a couple of weeks. I should think there'll be interesting people there to talk to. So what was the upshot of it all then? On a week ago on Friday, where did you all end up?
Well, we ended up. We got the liability order. Actually, it's true because I got a workshop as well. So they did both at the same time. But there's nothing specially different about that one. But there was one interesting detail that Guy noticed in court, and that is when the magistrates got up to go out and consider, and they said something which Guy said is very, very rare. He's never seen it before. They said they wouldn't be buzzing for the clerk of the court to go in and confer with them.
And he's the guy who's got the knowledge.
Yeah. Now, the guy said he's never, ever seen that happen in a magistrate's court, ever.
It's interesting that they announced it, too.
Yeah, and he thinks that there was something going on between the magistrates and the clerk, or something was going on, right, where they didn't want him in there for some reason.
Well, you'd caused a fair... You'd been, like, chucking a wasp's nest into the place. I shouldn't think they were thinking very clearly.
No. So what happened was, as soon as they said that they weren't going to call him in, he leapt up. And rushed across there and gave them the usual spiel about it says in the statute, if the person doesn't pay, then the magistrate shall issue a liability order. He sort of rushed up there and got there, and I gave him a hug. After they'd gone out, I really moaned at him about it.
Yeah.
I said, look, I said, they told you that, and then you dashed up there and reminded them of the statute. I said, I think that's just really off that. And he didn't like it. He looked down. A guy said something to him as well about something, and he went all sheepish.
Because really, the magistrates are nominally in charge, aren't they? And all the other guys in there are there to help them do their job.
Well, yeah, that's supposed to be the way it is, but that's not really what happens.
No.
Fundamentally, the clerk of the court runs the court.
And is quite often the only man in there with real technical knowledge, because the magistrates are quite often untrained volunteers.
Oh, yeah, they don't know much about the law at all. So it's the clerk of the court. I think they have to have 5 years' experience as a solicitor, in order to qualify for being a clerk of the court. Okay. So they are the people.
It does sound like he had an agenda.
Oh, yeah, well, they all have.
Well, yeah, I guess so. I'm still an idealist at heart, even after all this.
Oh, no. In fact, all the talk of arresting judges and everything, it has been observed that the people we really need to be arresting are the clerks.
Mm.
Because they are, I mean, it's a slime ball.
Mm.
But interestingly enough, while we're on the topic of the power and the role of the clerks, I read in the there's a piece on a website I read about the SESTUKV trusts.
Yeah, I've been reading that as well. Yeah. Mary Elizabeth Croft essay I read on it. The three trusts that are created when you're born.
Yeah.
One for yourself, one for your body, one for your soul, or something.
Right. Apparently, the SESTUKV trust is fundamentally it's the statute that allows somebody to claim ownership of property if the person can be proved dead for 7 years,
right,
lost at sea,
that's
and all
it,
of that
yes.
stuff.
Yeah.
Well, apparently there is. I really don't know enough about this, but I've been assured that that is the sort of trust that's set up with the birth certificate.
Yeah, I think
so.
Yes.
For the first 7 years of the child's life. They are something like an ordinary person or ordinary human being.
Yeah.
But after the age of seven, then they technically become a dead person.
They're deemed lost at sea.
Unless somebody reclaims them,
right,
brings them back or whatever. But there's another aspect of SESTUKV trusts, which is this analysis I read of it, is that's what happens when you go into court.
Yes.
The clerk's job is to set up a SESTUKV trust purely for the length of that trial.
Correct.
And the purpose of it is to shift you from being beneficiary of your trust into the liability, the liable person.
Yeah.
Because apparently the true nature of a court case is that the liability lies with the prosecution. because they are the ones that are making an accusation.
That's right. Apparently they actually have to have their purse with them.
Yeah. That's right. Mm. So, but apparently the administrator in all of this is the clerk. It hasn't got anything to do with...
And the executor is the judge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Mm. So the clerk's role, again, is hidden from us, but it's very, very powerful.
Yeah.
Because that... And when you watch them in operation, there is something power behind the throne type of quality to them.
One of the chaps I was talking to tells me that there is a representative of the City of London that sits behind the Speaker's chair in the House of Commons and whispers in his ear.
Oh.
And you just think, you kind of look at that little back door and listening to what you're saying about the clerks, you can suddenly see how there could easily be just this whole thing around them and all they know what's going on.
Yeah.
They're the only one who does.
Yeah.
And so you can run the whole... They're, if you like, the jesters that were hired in... Yeah. In Darrell's court to entertain, you know, to entertain the king and the queen.
Yeah.
The clerks of the court are the guys who are bringing in the people.
Yeah.
And are making sure that they lose their heads and they lose their money and that the jesters or the judges keep theirs.
Yeah. Well, I observed...
Hence they rush up to them and go, pay attention, guys.
Yeah.
You know.
I observed a bit of this in the subsequent hearing that happened after the council tax one was done.
Oh, so you hung around to see what happened next,
well,
did you?
Well, the magistrate said, well, we are granting a liability order, so you know you're free to go. And then the clerk said, oh, yeah, but we want to hear this seatbelt thing as well.
Oh, okay.
Because what had happened was that... I think I've said pretty much everything about the council tax case.
That's very good.
So, it's about a year and a half ago.
So there you go, folks. You're back live with... Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com. We've been listening to Pete talking about his experience in the magistrate's court. I stopped it there because basically he was going to move on to another subject, which hopefully we'll get to cover a little bit later. During the meanwhile, to give you all a break, because I'm sure you've all been very attentive, I'll play a bit of music and I'm going to try and get Pete on the line so that we can have I can have a bit of a live chat with him about where he's got to over the week since that hearing. And also, you know, there's perhaps a few things there which you might be able to revisit, because I'm sure there was lots and lots of interesting things in there. In the meantime, this is Gossip, Standing in the Way of Control. Well, you're back live with Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com, and I've got Pete, the man we've been listening to, talking about his experiences in the magistrate's court recently. Are you still with me, Pete?
Yeah, I'm here, yeah.
Very good. If you could let me know in the chat box whether you can hear this, that would be really great. It's sounding and looking good from here, though. So how's it been going, Pete? It's been 3 or 4 weeks since that quite busy Friday you had. Has there been any movement on anything since then?
I've got you playing in the background. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, you need to turn that off, else it'll be really confusing.
Okay, how do I turn that off? I can't quite... Just hold the line a sec.
Yeah, not a problem. This is something that we all experience. I remember when I first encountered the strange broadcasting echo. Right.
Yeah, I've just paused it. So
that's very good. Yeah, if you don't turn the radio off, it is a bit like getting into a Doctor Who set or something. It's very confusing.
Oh dear. So we okay, are we?
Yeah, we're fine. We should be fine. Is everybody all right?
There's
nobody complaining in the chat box anyway. That's always a good sign. That's might mean that they're not listening at all. Of course. I doubt that. So what's been going on since you were in the hearing, what, 3 or 4 weeks ago now, isn't it?
It's just one little bit that I didn't mention that happened in the court after that bit where the clerk of the court dashed up and spoke to the magistrates when they ran out, and then I moaned at him because he'd been telling them all the statute stuff. But Guy gave him a real hard time because he said, you're inciting the magistrates to break the law, referring back to the oath and all of that stuff. And he really didn't like it. He really looked down. He didn't want to engage at all. And meantime, the lady, the magistrate that got bumped off at the very beginning, she was still sitting there. It looked like she was taking notes. She was really wondering what was going on.
I suppose it must have been quite an educational experience for them all.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly sounds like the clerk of the court was earning his money that day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was, yeah. And there was there's another detail that I wanted to mention as well. I've realised since that that I had misunderstood a little bit about what Roger was doing in the Birkenhead case, because it wasn't so much the issuing of the summonses that he was complaining about. It was actually the issuance of the liability orders. Because what I've realised is that it looks as though the courts don't issue the orders, it's the council that does. And that was the argument that Roger was having with the council tax people in Birkenhead. He wanted the council tax people to be called to give evidence to confirm that it was them that had printed the liability order and not the court. So what I've decided to do, since I realised that, I've just written to the court today asking them to give me copies of the liability orders. And in the alternative, I would like to make an arrangement to come in and inspect them for myself. And I'm pretty sure they're going to tell me that it's nothing to do with them. It's going to be the council. This is another piece in the jigsaw, because if the council needs to go to the court to get a liability order, we all know that the liability order has to be signed with a wet signature by the justices. And if they're going to tell me that they don't issue them, then I'm going to be chasing the council to find out what the hell's going on.
So what we're basically saying here is that according to the actual, the sort of the rules or the orthodoxy or stuff, what happens is that the council applies to the justices for some sort of judgment as to whether a summons should be issued in these cases, and the justices then okay the issue of a summons. But what we're suspecting is happening here is that in the place of those justices, we've actually got more members of the council. So we're saying that the council are accusing you of something, and then there's another load of people from the council in the court who are saying, yeah, issue the summons. So,
but moving on from the issuance of the summons.
The liability orders. Yeah,
the liability.
It's the same point order, though, so, is that there should so, be just.
Because this is what happened in Rogers. I think it wasn't the final hearing, the one where the judge got arrested. It was the one before that I also attended.
Yeah,
and there was a whole load of talk about whether these documents were fraudulent or not, because both John and Roger in that hearing said that they looked at the documents and they were watermarked by the council, and they were claiming to be liability orders. But the thing is, if they've gone to court and they need the authority of the magistrates to make a judgment as to whether a liability order should be issued, surely it's the justices that should issue the order, not the council.
I want to
see a wet signature from a justice on the order, not something from the council. Well, so that's going to lead, if that turns out to be the case, that's going to lead into a whole load of questioning from myself.
Why you're highly likely to get the result you're expecting there. I've suspected for some time, and that means that some, you know, what I regard as an authoritative source, or several authoritative sources, must have said this to me. It sounds like a pretty significant thing to be proving. I'm surprised that nobody's had a go at it before, or have they, and found it a bit difficult to crack.
Roger did have a go at it, but what happened was in the last but one hearing, Roger said that he wanted. Because the council tax leader and her second in command, whoever he was, they were both sitting at the end of the table just to Roger's right. And Roger said to the judge, "Will you please call Mrs. Chang to give evidence to confirm whether or not the council issued these documents?" But the judge refused to call her as a witness.
Right.
But then he did say that he'd adjourn it, etc., etc. But he wouldn't call her as a witness, and Roger wants to know why. So, but then after that all went quiet, and the next thing he knew, he had to go to court to answer a bankruptcy application.
And is that still progressing, that case? I mean, is he going to get a chance to revisit that, or has that one been dragged to a...
No, that one. They just after the judge was arrested on the 7th of March, they signed the bankruptcy petition. So they got their bankruptcy petition even after the judge was arrested.
And did that
without any further hearings, as far as I know.
Did that come as a surprise to you all?
No, I don't think it did. No.
Because it's like you said when we were talking in that in the bit we've just heard, you said quite rightly, in my opinion, I've made a similar point myself, that it appears that none of our forays, you know, not your accept for value, not your conditional agreement, absolutely nothing we do seems to prevent these liability orders being signed.
No, that's right. They got earplugs in.
Yeah.
So I'm prepared to do whatever it takes to corner them on just exactly what it is that they're doing, and if it turns out you can't corner them, well, fair enough. But it'd be great to actually get to the bottom of what it is that they're actually doing.
Well, I think as we discussed, you know, by thinking about the questions that you're going to ask, and by kind of going in there with whatever rules are available to you and trying to play those rules and things, each time, and especially as I pointed out, you know, by doing the unexpected, you are definitely you're definitely encouraging these people to they can't keep up with what's going on. They're having to behave really quite rapidly and on the spot, and so you're getting to discover new stuff as a result of what you're doing.
But there's definitely something going on with the court hearing, the liability order, and the claim that they don't need a contract. There's something in there that is not logical. And they're doing something, and I really want to find out what it is.
Well, I'll tell you what. What we'll do is, really great to hear your voice live. You've been actually the first phone-in guest on the Dr. Rock Radio Show. So what I do now is play the rest of the bit that we recorded together, which deals with your failure to pay the nominal fine for your alleged not wearing of a seatbelt.
That's right, crime of the century there.
Yeah, indeed. And then what I'll do is I'll play another tune after that. I'll get you back on the line, and then we can spend the rest of the programming shooting the breeze and maybe taking some questions from people in the chat box.
Yeah, great stuff.
Okay, right. Yeah, well, I'll put on the rest of this. It looks like it's pretty much back where it was, and then I'll get you back a little bit later.
Great.
Pete. Here we go. Here's the second part.
And actually, if you read the back of the original ticket, you will find that there is provision for that in there. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't really interested in arguing along those lines.
No.
So they dragged me into court over it about a year ago. And that was the time when I refused to walk into the court. And,
right.
and the magistrates all walked out, etc., etc.
Yeah.
And then I sent them because me and Guy dismissed the case on that occasion.
Which they then ignored and go and rubber stamp everything anyway.
Yeah, so the day after we were in court, I sent them a notice of confirmation of case dismissal and explained exactly why that we dismissed the case and why they'd basically done it.
Yeah. They left the ring.
Yeah, because if you think about it, they refused to accept my jurisdiction.
Yeah. Yeah,
but, you mean you can't have jurisdiction if you don't earn it.
No.
So, and I think I earned mine because in the confirmation of case dismissal notice, I actually asked them the question, sent it to the clerk of the court. I asked the question. I can't find any rules or regulations anywhere to say I can't stand wherever I want in the court. No answer. What I got back was a letter saying there's no question of dismissing the case. Da da da. I still owe the money. And put a new date for a hearing, which I didn't go to. Oof. There's lots of complications in between.
So you don't go to all hearings, you choose when you want to go, do you?
No, with that one, I mean, they shouted at me so much, I thought, bugger it, I'm not going back again.
Excellent, I'm glad to hear it.
But I just didn't want to be obeying orders anyway.
No.
But of course, the letter said, if you don't attend, a warrant will be issued for your arrest, which duly happened.
Right.
So ever since...
So they issued the warrant for your arrest, they haven't come and arrested you, have they?
No.
No.
That's ever since September of last year... Right through until the present day, nobody has ever come round to arrest me.
No, well, that's probably because the warrant might be quite difficult to enforce, don't you think?
Possible, but they probably haven't got time.
No, they probably haven't, but I'm pretty sure the warrant would prove to be impossible to document and verify as well, because I'm gather most of them are.
Yeah, it could have been.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I was thinking, well, it's actually the same courthouse I'm going to. They're probably going to bring it up when I go in for the council tax thing.
Okay.
Which they duly did.
Yeah. Actually, that's quite together of them.
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily have assumed they'd be that together.
All right. But well, I was relatively confident, that's why I have my folder with me.
Yeah.
So I had all the stuff in the folder. So they start having this after the council tax one was done and dusted. So then they start
so
having
basically
this.
They just issue the liability order and they assume you're going to pay and they go that's all that then.
Don't know.
Well, wait and see, I suppose.
Actually, funnily enough, the magistrates did ask about what we do next, and the clerk had to tell them that don't do anything because it's that down to the council now. So they were obviously a bit confused about that as well.
Well, the next thing I'll do is sell it to bailiffs anyway.
Probably.
So, anyway.
So,
yeah.
So, with this seatbelt thing, so, what it, now it's interesting because, fixed penalty notices don't depend on due process. They just depend on a demand for money.
Yeah.
And the legislation allows them to do it.
Mm.
More treason by the Queen.
Yeah.
Signing it into law.
Yeah.
That's another story. So, this hearing is an enforcement hearing.
Okay.
Now, interestingly enough, on one occasion I did go down to the Central Finance Office and ask them what they were actually doing about this, because I'd sent my conditional offers in and a default notice and I hadn't heard anything from them.
Yeah.
So about a month went past, so I went down there and asked them. Sure, we didn't understand all that stuff you sent in. So, well, I'll explain to you if you like. We got talking about it. And he at one point he said to me, he said, well, if you didn't agree with it, why didn't you ask to have it heard in court? And I said, because the tear-off slip on the bottom of the ticket that invites you to ask for a court hearing contains incriminating questions. I was the driver of the vehicle at the time, ticked the box.
Yeah.
I said, that's unlawful to... You're not allowed to ask incriminating questions. You've got to issue a summons, you issue a summons.
Yeah.
Because I've since realised that that's completely asked about face anyway. If they want to prosecute, they should prosecute you. They should ask you to ask.
No,
to be prosecuted.
Yes, please. Although, of course, we both know, don't we, that that's essentially what's happening.
Yeah.
They are going, do you want to go to prison? And we're going, yes.
Yeah. Where do I sign?
Tick, yeah.
So anyway, I was in the office and he said, well, if you didn't like it, why didn't you ask to... So I said, well, because there's incriminating questions on the slip.
Yeah.
He said, well, we can send you a summons if you want. So I said, well, yeah, please do.
Yeah.
And that was that. Walked out and I got halfway across the car park and thought, hang about a minute. So I walked back in and this fellow had just come down for his lunch. And I said to him, just by the way, when you said you'd send me a summons, will it be a summons for the original offence, or will it be a summons to enforce the debt? Well, I don't know that yet, do I, he said. That's a bit funny, you ought to know. Because the conversation was, if you didn't agree with it, why didn't you ask?
Yeah.
I assumed at first that they'd send me a summons for the original offence.
Not wearing the safety belt.
Not wearing a seatbelt.
Yeah.
So, eventually, we'll cut a long story short, they did send a summons, and it did turn out to be an enforcement summons, not for the original offence. So basically, they're still in the same box that I always thought they were in.
Yeah.
So, eventually, I did go to court, and that's the time when I got them to walk out.
Yeah.
But what I've since realised is that these enforcement hearings, all they are is like a means inquiry. And in fact, the senior legal advisor in Brecon actually said that in the letter. She said that the purpose of the hearing that you attended was to conduct a means inquiry to see how you're going to pay the money.
This was the one that you got them to walk out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, well, that's very interesting. So once again, you're deemed guilty.
Yeah.
And all.
It's just a question of how you're going to pay.
Yeah. How you're going to pay. Yeah. So, and so it turned out that's what this one was a week ago. And so he gave me one of these means inquiry forms and said, fill that in. I said, I'm not filling that in.
Well, yeah, I was wondering about that, because, of course, we got one of those with the council tax. Just got sent back with no contract.
That's it.
Return to sender.
That's right.
And I'm thinking, how do they deal with that, then? Because they have to do that. They have to find out whether you can pay and by what means, don't they?
Yeah.
So their result is, apparently, you get a summons, then they give you the bit of paper in the court, then.
Well, no, they'd sent me them before.
Yeah, but when you turned...
But when I was actually in court, he said, fill it in. Oh, I'm not filling that in. So he then proceeds to start asking me all these sneaky questions about income and everything, which I semi-answered, sort of. But then I wasn't really thinking, because I'd been at it for over 2 hours.
For a while, yeah.
So I was wiped out, quite honestly.
Yeah.
So then I started not handling things quite the way I ought to have done. And at one point, I actually went into the witness box and he kept on asking me these means inquiry questions. So I looked at Guy and I said, I think we ought to just dismiss this case and bugger off. Because I said, this is a waste of time.
Yeah.
So I got up to walk out and these Muppets grabbed me because, of course, there was a warrant for my arrest.
Okay.
And then they chucked Guy and my friend from home out onto the street, but I didn't realise. I thought they'd gone out in the waiting room. They actually threw them out of the building and stuck me in the dock. And so this clerk kept on... After this, it really got interesting. So the clerk kept on asking me these means inquiry questions.
Yeah. Well, how did you respond to those?
Well, I kept on saying things. I haven't got any money.
Yeah.
Have you got any savings? No, I haven't got any money. Yeah. Stuff like that.
Money doesn't exist, mate.
Then the clerk suddenly seemed to want to be my friend. He said, I think there may be a way out of this. He said, if you'd be prepared to sign a form. So I thought, oh. He said, if you just be quiet for a minute, because I was being a bit uppity. He said...
It actually bloody dragged you into the dock.
Yeah.
Blimey.
Yeah. And the enforcement officer in the court actually held the warrant up to the glass for me to read. After he'd locked me in there. I've since discovered, actually, that enforcement officers in courts aren't allowed to make arrests.
Not allowed to touch you, are they?
No, that's another story.
Yeah,
I'll be sending them something about
very
that.
Very good, yeah.
But, so the clerk, he then says, he starts talking to the magistrates, same magistrates. The lady was back on there because it wasn't a council thing anymore.
It's okay, you can come out of the sin bin.
she was reinstated. So, so he said, yeah, he said, you're actually claiming that you never had a summons for this court order back last May that had bumped the amount of money up. And I said, right. No, I said, I never had a summons for it.
Didn't know anything about it at all.
So he said, well, if you would sign a statutory declaration to say that you never received that summons, then the case can be set aside, go back to the prosecution, and they can decide what they want to do about it. I said, that sounds all right.
And statutory declaration was where you started the day, wasn't it?
This is where it gets interesting.
Yeah.
So they let me out the dock, went out to the waiting room, and the Muppets brought me a form. Turned out to be the wrong form, so they went back and got the right one. But these forms had written across the top, and so basically all the form says, I did not receive the summons. So I knew nothing about the hearing, whatever it says.
Yeah.
Across the top, it says Statutory Declarations Act 1835, Section 18. Now, it eventually turned out that it wasn't the right form and they couldn't use it, so they had to carry on and hear the case. And the reason why they couldn't use it was because I hadn't returned that tear-off slip asking for a summons.
Wow.
So because I hadn't asked for the summons, it was obvious that I wasn't going to get one because I hadn't asked for one. In their Muppet minds...
Blimey.
In their robot minds, the system is so honed to...
Getting you in.
Yeah. Well, it's so honed to you pay the money.
Yeah.
And if you want to make an argument about it, you've got to ask for it.
Yeah, and that...
Which is completely unlawful.
Yeah.
Then none of the get-out clauses apply. Because presumably, if I had done that slip, then they would have sent me a summons.
Yeah.
So, but who knows? It might only have been an enforcement summons. We don't know yet.
And you signed the piece of paper with that tear-off slip on it, did you?
No, I never signed anything.
Right, okay.
On the roadside, I never signed it. So I've still got the ticket, it is unsigned.
Right, and you got away with that as well? They didn't insist that you signed
it? No, I was amazed. He said, sign here, and I said, no, I'm not signing anything. So he just gave it to me.
You know what to do if they threaten to break your fingers and they want you to sign, do you? Solution is to put a BY and a colon on it. By, sign it by with a colon and then your signature, and that way apparently it can only be used for the signing of that ticket. And you're taking power of attorney for that signature.
Oh.
So it's the one where basically, yeah, don't sign anything, but if they're going to break your fingers, if you don't sign, then put by, sign it, and then just send it back to them the next day.
Right.
I think that's the method.
Right. So
so they let you have the ticket without signing it. That's quite interesting as well. Did that surprise you? Which surprised me, I think. Because your signature's one of the things they really want, isn't it?
I would have thought so, but he didn't seem to. Maybe he didn't know enough, I don't know.
Right, okay.
So eventually it turned out that I couldn't use this form anyway, so it couldn't be set aside.
Yeah, so you had to deal with it there.
Yeah.
Then.
So then there's another anomaly.
And are you still in the dock at this point?
No, they let me out because I was in the waiting room.
Right, okay, yeah.
When all this was happening.
Yeah.
So these forms. So I filled in one. I looked at it and looked at it. I thought there isn't anything on here that is wrong.
Right.
It was dead straight.
Yeah.
There's no tricks, nothing.
Mm.
So eventually, I did fill one and signed it in, and then the clerk of the court came out into the waiting room and said da 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 da. Got the dates didn't seem right. So he eventually figured out that because I hadn't signed it, he said, "Well, did you ask for a prosecution?" I said, "No, of course I didn't." "Oh, well," he said, "in that case, you can't use this then, because you can't have it set aside because you didn't
ask for it in the first place.
So that's why you never got a summons, because you never asked for one."
Oh, that's pretty spooky, isn't it?
It is very spooky. But in the meantime, I finished up with a couple of these forms in my wallet. So when I got back, talked to Guy, and we thought, bloody hell. Because I'd given them all this spiel about statutory declarations. Yeah. And how they can be prosecuted under it. Now, they told us, because I didn't handle it right in the court, and these forms all got put into the mix, we got handed a form that we sign, that gets signed by the magistrate, which becomes an instrument in law. So it says across the top, Statutory Declaration Act 1835, Section 18, and Section 18 is the section that confers the right on every person to make a statutory declaration and then get it witnessed by a commissioner for oaths. So we've decided now that this may be a way of forcing stuff into evidence, because if we make a statutory declaration and put it across the top, Section 18, and then get it witnessed by a solicitor for your fiver or whatever it is, then that becomes evidence in law, because you have signed under pain of perjury.
Would three upstanding signatures from the society do as well?
I don't know, but
I think three signatures generally do as well as a notary, don't they? And just in case you have difficulties getting it signed by anybody else.
But this isn't notary. This is an ordinary commissioner,
right?
So that would be any solicitor that charges you a fiver to witness the signing of a
commissioner of oath.
Yeah. So you put your hand on the book.
Yeah.
And say, "I swear, this is the truth," and you sign, and he signs it and puts the firm stamp on. Mm-hmm. So it's a beautifully structured.
So they again, this is something that does seem to happen quite often. They effectively gave you by mistake something that you really need.
Solid gold.
I save you a lot of trouble finding it.
Oh boy, because you see, we hadn't really looked at the Statutory Declarations Act in any other context. From how it incriminates them.
Yeah.
But now we've discovered that the Act is full of stuff that may well help us.
Yeah.
To get our observations of law actually get it heard into evidence.
Yeah.
Because Guy was saying that if you really think about it, you make a statement under oath, it's exactly the same as if you were in the witness box. Now, apparently, Guy thinks that if I'd been in the witness box under oath and read that page of Archibald's out to them, they would have had to have taken it more seriously.
And that's the witness box, not the dock.
No, the witness box.
The witness box, yeah. Okay.
Because you've sworn on oath.
Yeah.
And under pain of perjury, I think in court it's 7 years mm-hmm. for perjury. With one of these documents, I think it's only 2 years, if you lie.
Yeah.
So we've now been given a whole avenue of investigation, which suggests that we can put stuff into evidence sworn, and it may actually be stronger than affidavit. Mm. But we need to understand what force a statutory declaration has, as opposed to an affidavit.
Yeah, so you'll be going back to the Act again.
Yeah. And
where would you find information about the relative values of the two, though? Is that back to...
Don't know. Mm. Don't know. But the thing is that it got given to me by accident.
Yeah.
And it turned out it wasn't even applicable to my case anyway.
But
as soon as I saw it across the top, I thought, hang about, that's just what I've been saying
that's
to them.
Right. Yeah.
Now they're wanting me to authorise something that I'm saying, but they refuted the fact that it applied to them.
Yeah. And
very interesting.
And then they said you couldn't use the form anyway.
That's right, but I finished up with them in my folder and I brought them home. So what I thought Guy's observations were really, really interesting is that if I had made, so technically I could have put Statutory Declarations Act 1835, Section 18, it is my honest belief that, full page of Archibald's, about Statutory Declarations Act that binds them to their oaths, might actually have stopped them if it had been in that form.
Yeah.
But because I was just standing there saying it, not in the witness box under oath,
they shouted at
me, that's just your opinion. Yeah. And it may be that in...
Wouldn't have been your opinion in the witness box under oath.
No, because it would have been a statement in law, sworn under oath.
Yeah.
Interesting, isn't it?
But the stuff's only in the book in the first place because it is what you just described. The Archibald stuff is that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Statements that were made in law that have turned out to be, you know... They haven't been refuted. So, although it was you saying it's outside the witness box and not under oath, you were quoting somebody who is used habitually in the courts as a reference for rectitude.
Yeah, but if to make it real in actual practice, what would need to happen is that indictment would need to be typed up, put into the justices. And then they would say, yes, the prosecution can go ahead. And then they would have done all the signings.
Yeah.
And, of course, they're all under oath all the time. So then that would have made it official. And then the court system's glasses, blindfold, would have to come off. And then they would have to see it.
Yes. Yeah.
Whereas if we just stand there as an advocate saying this stuff to them, they can't actually see it.
Because there's a bit of them that believe that you don't even have the right to turn up to be an advocate, isn't there?
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a class of feeling in the courts that says that only professionals should be in there doing what you're trying to do.
Oh, absolutely. But, of course, they can't stop you self-litigating.
No.
But they hate it.
Because
self-litigants know too much, I think.
Yes. Yes.
And, of course, they've also got a vested interest, which advocates haven't got.
Mm.
So that was very, very interesting. So that statutory declarations business, it really needs to be studied and looked into.
Well, we'll try and gather the bits of paper that you've been describing as well and see if we can get them posted up. That'd be good. And once again, it comes down to looking at the Acts, really. They're worth looking at, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because they contain these little gems, such as the one that you had handed to you.
That's right.
Reading through them, I'm sure you find more.
Well, we've got into the habit now, as soon as something like comes up, we go straight onto the internet and get the Act up.
Yeah.
Print it out.
I
just haven't had time since. I've been so busy doing other stuff.
Yeah.
But that is my next job, is to get that one and read the whole thing.
Brilliant, yeah.
We've read Section 18, and it says everything that we thought it would say.
So you've got no outstanding summonses then now?
No.
Asked for or not?
Well, I've got the next thing I've had the council sent me the notification of the liability orders, but I actually want to see them.
See the actual liability orders? Yes, I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, and I want to see what they say. I want to see the signatures on them.
Yeah.
And I also want to explain to them is because the magistrates were on their oath, but sitting in the wrong court, that they have no force anyway.
No, and anyway, if they're orders, they're chargeable.
Well,
it means that if you fulfil them, you just charge them twice as much for fulfilling the order as they're charging you.
Right.
So if they say you owe them 600 quid, you say, great, I'll charge you 1,200 quid, you can have it.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, that might be nice. So I've yet to decide what to do about challenging the liability orders, but something will happen, that's for sure.
It'd be interesting, won't it, to see how our two different approaches work. Because we, of course, just sending it all back now, really, largely on the basis of what we were saying earlier, that there doesn't seem to be anybody with mind for you to deal with directly. So, but yes, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
I'm not in the slightest bit fazed by the fact that they got the orders. The only thing I do need to do is to make sure that the house is protected.
Yes.
But apart from that, bailiffs don't really worry me too much.
No. I would imagine that surely the means of defending things must be to put them... I don't know what trusts are, and I'm not particularly interested, as you can probably tell. I have simple taste in techniques for this sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that, reading as I do regularly Private Eye, I'm aware that the wealthy people and the people that do use trusts a lot to defend the stuff they've got and to prevent it from, you know... So that's got to, I would have thought that's got to be one way of looking at it, hasn't it?
I think so. That's one. The other thing is that because I own my own house outright, I could just sell it to somebody for a quid.
Yes. Because, of course, your worry is that for refusing to pay council tax, they tend to drive for bankruptcy rather than prison. That's your concern.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't heard of anybody going to prison for it for years now.
No.
But bankruptcies I have heard about.
Yeah. Do you have bank accounts?
I've got a bank account, but it's not particularly...
Because, I'd put it straight in a building society, because bankrupt means bankrupt. They can't get at it in a building society.
Can't they?
No. Because when I eventually abandoned the banking system about 15 years ago, I put all my money in, what money I had, which wasn't a lot, I put it in a building society, and that way it's outside the jurisdiction of them, apparently, and they can't have it off you. And
do you need to be choosy about which society it is?
I went for a mutual just because of the intent. I mean, unfortunately, all of their funds are held at Barclays anyway.
Yeah.
But I went for a little Welsh one. You know, I can only get money out here or in counties adjacent to the border.
Oh, so, is that right?
Yeah, I put it in the principality.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
I haven't had a bank account for 15 years. And that's the first thing that the, because he was, what do they call him, an insolvency practitioner, came and saw me and helped me through the whole process, because I just basically, I didn't have anything to lose at all, apart from shed loads of debt to the bank. And I knew that I wasn't going to get back on the ladder again. I wasn't ever going to have a mortgage or need the credit or anything, and I haven't had any credit at all since that. And, that was what the first thing he said. He said, well, take the money out of the bank and put it in here, because then they can't touch it. So as far as I can gather, bankruptcy does refer specifically to those sort of accounts. The other thing is, once you've got it in a mutual, you do have your own reference number for your funds, but it's actually a massive consolidated account.
Ah.
And all the checks that are written for you are written against that account, against cleared funds, effectively.
So it's not even your account?
No.
Oh,
no.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll consider that, but I don't really keep much in there. The only reason I've got it is because a couple of standing orders go out every month.
Yeah.
But they could go from a building society, couldn't they?
I think they only do inward coming stuff. I don't think ours would do outward going.
Oh.
Not the mutuals anyway, and you know, they don't get a chequebook or anything like that either. They write the checks for you.
Yeah.
It'd be quite interesting to see what happens there, because for a while the electricity company were actually refusing to take cheques. They were insisting that we pay in cash over the post office counter, which seemed completely crazy. But, I mean, knowing what I know now, I'm starting to question the paying of the electricity.
Yeah, I'm questioning that as well.
This last bill was absolutely massive. You know, I can't do to my customers what they're doing to me.
No.
I can't go around to people's gardens and say, you know, it cost you £200 to maintain it last year, this year I'm going to do less but charge you £400.
Yeah.
Can't do it, so... Well, I think that was a very interesting chat. Thank you very much.
That was great.
And I think it was all quite nice and clean. We just take the...
Very good. You're back live with Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com. And we've been listening to Pete talking there about the end of the council tax hearing and the enforcement hearing for his alleged failure to wear a safety belt. I'm going to play a couple of tunes now, give you all a bit of a rest from the voices, and whilst the second tune's playing, I'll give Pete a ring. We'll get him back on the line, and because I think there's some interesting things. Once again, you move so quickly over quite a lot of material there, and I think there's one or two very interesting points that we might be able to discuss. And obviously, if anybody's got any questions, if you'd like to put them into the chat box, which can be found at tnsradio.ning.com, where you can come and join lots of like-minded people, ask questions of us, and get something that at least approaches a matter of opinion, possibly even several. In the meantime, here's some music for you. Thanks for being there, folks. I'm really enjoying myself. I hope you're in. I'm back, everybody. Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com. I'm hoping that I've got Pete back with me on the line. You there, Pete?
Yeah, I'm here, yeah.
Very good. If ever you can hear him out there, let me know in the chat box. It's looking good from here, though. So we've heard the whole of your story there, including the little golden egg that you managed to earn for yourself at the end of the day as a reward for all your efforts.
That was really great, that, yeah. Yeah, so we are still talking about how to use that. We still need to make sure the form of words is right, and we need also to test it out to make sure that it really does work.
Yes, well, I should think you've got plenty of opportunities lined up, have you, where you could try such a thing?
Yeah, I think we have.
And I
know Guy's got a case on Monday, so that he might be going to use it there, but I'm not sure if it's going to be the right time for it.
Right,
so
yes.
We'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see how that one goes as well.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering if we could kind of work through some of the stuff that we covered there. Because obviously a lot of it's very new and innovative, and just see if we might squeeze any more, so, you know, put a bit of meat on the bones, because obviously we move quite quickly over a lot of detail there.
Yeah. There was one point that I did want to make. It occurred to me partway through the program.
Yeah.
Is that in the free man movement, the lawful rebellion movement, there's the whole emphasis is on having things happen according to common law, and there are people around who are not sure about the so much use of statute because when I first started to get involved with all this stuff, it was seen as that was all their stuff and it was usurping common law, etc. But in fact, lots and lots of statute is in fact an enactment of common law and been put into statute. Very often weakened or usurped in some way or another, but with the Statutory Declarations Act, it's a classic example of what I believe is a restatement of common law, and so the common law can't actually be killed. We all know this in truth, although they'll try to maintain that it is, but that particular act. Or that section of the Act is there for us to use, and it really it does enforce common law, but of course it's in their writing, so they actually are in a position where they might have to hear it.
I think that's a very good point. It's something that that came out when I was talking to the Spaniard the other day as well. That some statute definitely works for our benefit, and I mean, one of the ones that he quoted to me, which I've looked at since, is the Misrepresentation Act, 1967. Yeah. There's hardly any of it, and it's really, really useful, you know.
Yeah.
And you're right. The thing is, I don't think they'd necessarily have been able to get away with so effectively suborning the common law if they'd just ridden over it roughshod. Do you know what I mean?
That's right. No, they've been very clever in rewriting it.
Well, the church did the same thing, didn't it? When the church moved in on ancient sites, where people had probably been doing, you know, whatever they do for generations and generations, they kind of subsumed the sort of local spirits and energies and what have you, and attributed them to a local saint and all of that, and tried to make it look, you know, pretty much like it fitted in. So that, of course, is why having all of the acts on the internet is so useful, isn't it? Because we can actually go looking.
Yeah. And of course, we have to also thank our friend, our neighbour John, for pointing out that in the Bill of Rights of 1689, the Declaration of Rights, one of the provisions is it actually defines what Parliament is supposed to do. In fact, it's the only thing in it that says anything about the power of Parliament at all. And I've got it in front of me. It says that for redress of all grievances and for the amending, strengthening and preserving of the laws, Parliaments ought to be held frequently.
Is that what a Parliament's for, is it?
Pardon?
Is that what a Parliament's for?
Yeah. And according to John, that is the only thing that Parliament is supposed to do, to amend, strengthen and preserve laws. It's not allowed to write new laws, and it's not, in fact, allowed to change them. It's just to make them more useful for modern times, as far as I understand it. But
yes.
That is the actual words of the Declaration of Rights itself.
This is a document.
The Declaration and the Bill of Rights of 1689. It's the one where the coronation oath comes from.
Yes, yes.
So that actually defines that. That is what gives Parliament its power to sit. That two sentences, that one sentence.
And when we look at what they're doing, we find that they're doing pretty much the opposite of what they might think they're there for.
Now this opens up actually another enormous great area that I've only just recently started to have a look at, which is the Muad'Dib's case.
What was that?
You know the case where didn't he send the 7/7 ripple effect DVDs to the jury in the 7/7 inquest, and he got extradited from Ireland and stood trial in England for it.
Oh right, can you just put a bit of flesh on that? I haven't heard about that, and there might be other people.
Oh, there was a big thing. There was whole campaigns against him being extradited and everything. But if you Google Muad'Dib or JAH, Queen's Oath, Coronation Oath.
Yeah.
It turns out that according to, and he won his case, and it seems he won it on this basis, although I don't know enough about it yet, but apparently the Coronation Oath that the Queen swore in
52, I think.
Yeah, apparently she swore on the Bible to uphold the laws of God or the laws of the Bible. And apparently, that in the first five books of the Bible, it actually defines that man is not allowed to write laws.
Mm.
And so his submission was that right from the very first time she ever signed a royal assent to the first act of her reign, she basically was abdicating.
That's because interesting, isn't it?
It contravened her coronation oath.
So that means effectively that a process kind of started there, which is then is sort of magnified and reflected upon itself and done again until you get to the huge scope of Nice and Rome and Lisbon.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing written larger and larger and larger, is it?
Yeah. Mm. So that Muad'Dib case, I've only just started to read it, so I'm not at all conversant in what it was, how it worked, but that is the one bit of it that I've got. So we've got judges and magistrates and the sovereign's oath under question anyway, and now it's under question for a rather different reason. Really worth reading up on. It looks fascinating.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And the other thing is that it gives us, a different model for a parliament, doesn't it? Because I, one of the questions that I'm constantly asked, because obviously people do tend to feel challenged by some of this material, and one of the questions I'm frequently asked is, well, you know, you can't shoot this one down in flames unless you've got something to put in its place.
Right.
And that sounds like a fair description of a parliament to me, and it so happens I was just listening to Mike Montagna earlier today on a podcast talking about he does this mathematically perfected economy program on TNS radio.
Yeah.
And he's had 40 years to think about it, so he's written down pretty loads and loads of things about how he'd do it, how laws could be made to work for our benefit. And
right.
They're formed obviously because he's looked carefully at what's not working in our current system, and he's trying carefully to model a system which would make up for that. And so what you get is like a new version of what the common law code must have been.
Oh.
The idea being that laws can only be made with the assent of the people, and they can also only be made if they're going to be frequently, you know, reasserted and examined and all of that. He's Mike Montagna's podcast, although it's obviously a very big and complicated thing. I think I'm in the 15th hour now, but he's got an archive on TNS, and if you start at the beginning, it all makes loads of sense, and it is a real genuine solution that he's been offering for some 40 years or so. And I'd say, you know, a combination of that sort of thing and this old idea of a parliament upholding that kind of law and basically performing exactly the kind of function that Mike's describing.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah, very interesting, yeah.
But in the meantime, we find ourselves in this really interesting position where, I mean, what can you say, really? The sort of situation you find yourself in where you've got a judge, what you manage to establish, you've got a judge who says that he's under, or a magistrate who says that he's under his oath, which means that he's in a common law court, but then he behaves as if he's in a statute court, which means that he's basically administering an unlawful oath, I think. Is that the phrase you used?
Yeah, that's the words of the statute.
And that he can be charged and prosecuted for that, just for being there and doing it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. I can read you the section on the page.
Mm.
Under the particulars of the offence are that a justice of the peace unlawfully administers an oath in a matter in which the said person had no jurisdiction, namely, and then state the case. The evidence says it must be proved that the defendant was at the relevant time a justice of the peace for the county mentioned in the indictment. Evidence of his acting as such will prima facie be sufficient. Further, that he administered an oath of the nature and touching the subject matter mentioned in the indictment. It is not necessary to show that he acted willfully in contravention of the statute. For doing so, even inadvertently, is punishable.
So this is a prima facie then, and
yeah.
it's epidemic, isn't it? I mean, it's happening every day.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And but the fact that they just keep waving away our objections and our submissions and carrying on regardless and continuing to fine us and put us in prison and everything in contravention of the oath that we've challenged them on, this is why people are more and more saying what only thing to do is arrest them.
Yes.
Because if they will not engage in a debate in law and concede that there may be some substance in the accusation that you're making to them, then what on earth are we supposed to do?
And at the same time, they say to you that you're only giving your opinion when you're reading from Archbold's, which is one of their very own Bibles.
Yeah, not just one of their very own, but pretty much the top one.
It's true, isn't it? It's
yeah.
it's how it's gone before.
Yes, Archbold's Criminal Pleadings, I think. It's a yearbook, but it's got just about everything that matters in it.
So
and they've printed it for their own use.
Yes. So presumably this is something that can.
I just couldn't get my breath when they were sitting there and just shouting at me, that's just your opinion, just your opinion. I said, but I'm reading out of your book.
Mm. Yes, but you weren't reading out of their book standing in the right place.
Yeah, it's beyond arrogance.
So presumably you'll be thinking of trying that then, will you, next time? The thing is that perhaps you don't have to, if you can write it down on this new form they gave you, you might not have to stand and read it out in the...
No, I think that might be my next step. I mean, I know there are some people that are quite keen on trying to arrest them, but I think with the assistance of the police,
this is
another part of the whole thing that the police are actually supposed to do their job, which is if an arrest is made, if an accusation and an arrest is made, they're supposed to take it seriously.
Mm. So where did it go, that? Because, I mean, I don't think any of us know what happened to the judge or the policeman that arrested him. Is that still progressing? Did anybody catch up with him?
What, the one in Birkenhead?
Yeah.
Well, no, as far as I know, that he hasn't been pursued at all. And, in fact, The couple of people that were arrested on the day, their proceedings are being held against them.
Mm-hmm.
There was a case recently. I'll see if the guy involved will come on and tell you about the case.
Yeah.
But I was actually at it. It was yesterday. But the whole thing about the rescue of the judge was gone into in great detail. Absolutely went straight over their heads. In the case against one of our guys that was arrested.
Yeah.
But the question now is beginning to surface again between us. Well, hey, what about pursuing the judge? So I think there may be action on that front, but I think they found it quite difficult to get police to take it seriously.
Mm. So we're actually at we seem there to be at a similar point that we're at with our returns for cause and our conditional agreements and stuff, in that we have what is clearly a valid, undeniable point, even a prima facie case of point, like you say.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And yet, we still don't seem to be making very much progress by turning up and having a go. I mean, we're learning more, which is the stated aim at this point. But do you think we made progress at Birkenhead, and do you see us making progress in the future here?
Well, I think so. Yeah, I think so. But I'm not quite sure which way it will go. I think we all need to keep talking to each other, and we all need to keep trying. Whatever comes our way to see if we can make things stick.
Mm.
I honestly don't know how or what's going to need to be done. I really, really don't know. It's fascinating to just keep on trying things and finding stuff out.
It certainly is, and perhaps it's important to remember as well, this is a point I think that needs to be remade quite regularly, is that we possibly have to regard success as being something less than what we might traditionally have been taught is total victory, you know, i.e. chasing them down and getting a piece of paper from them saying, yeah, okay, you owe us nothing.
Yeah.
It might be that we don't want to be cornered, do we? So we must expect them not to want to be cornered as well.
That's right.
So doing the kind of thing that you and Guy are doing, which is keeping it in open play, well, you know, and we might not be quite getting to them, but they're not quite getting to us, and who's learning more in the process?
That's right. Well, as I said before, their inability to engage in a proper argument, because I think one of the reasons why they don't want to do it is because their whole career and their salary and pension and everything depends on them playing that whole game. So they don't want to go there. They don't want to think about it. They just want their job and their careers to continue.
Mm.
But of course for us it's completely different. We're doing it because we're interested and completely fed up with getting pushed around. And so we've actually got a fundamental interest in discovering how it all works and how to counter it.
Yeah, we've basically got a one bunch of people who can't afford to discover what's going on, and another bunch of people who can't afford not to.
That's right. And of course there's another underpinning as well of where we're coming from, is that what I said earlier on in the interview, which is that we weren't born here to be slaves, and it's perfectly reasonable for any human being to say, I actually don't want to be pushed around. If you make a demand of me, I have every right to ask you to prove your claim. And I personally think that is a position of absolute truth. I don't need to tell any lies about it. To me, it's self-evident. But when you're countered by a whole mountain of statutory law, which is specifically designed to usurp the common law principle upon which I make that claim, then that whole system of usurpation is fundamentally based on a lie. And once you've based a structure on a lie, you have to keep on telling lies to support it all the time, right up to the present day. So to me, it's a structure of untruth, and what we're doing is a structure of truth. So it's not difficult to remain clear and interested in maintaining and developing the understanding of that.
No, I agree.
So there's a massive difference between the two worlds.
There is, and it's funny, isn't it? Because as we mentioned, really, we, because of circumstance, we're in a position that we can see both sides of the mirror.
Yeah, that's right.
It appears that the people we're dealing with, until you come out of the matrix or whatever, however we want to say it, fall down the rabbit hole, come through the looking glass, you can't see that this side of it exists.
That's right.
I'm interested, you see, the thing is that I'm very interested in your work, and I know there's many other people working in court. We spoke briefly, I think, on the phone earlier about the White Rabbit Group's idea of establishing a permanent court of record on the internet.
Yeah.
And what their plan is to enable people to basically scan in all of the documents from past or present cases, and obviously future cases, and they can, you know, under what you have it, you know, perjury or full commercial liability or what have you, and effectively have a parallel court made up of us, basically, because we can obviously elect ourselves onto juries. What do you reckon to that as an idea? Because we could perhaps move faster than the justice system, such as it is, and feed back from that. What do you reckon? How do you reckon that would work?
Sounds like a great idea.
I think it's a pretty well advanced idea. I brought it up. I had an email about it last week. I'm still hoping that next week I've been speaking with the Spaniard and with Jonathan. I'm hoping we'll be able to host quite an extensive conversation about that in this show next week.
Well, that'd be great.
It's a very interesting idea, and I know that some of the final touches are being put to it at the moment. But then, you see, because the problem is we don't seem to have any kind of benchmark, do we? We don't seem to be able to get any real purchase on these people.
It's quite possible that we won't succeed in getting the kind of purchase that we wish we could, but I think it's going to take shape as it goes along. But much dialogue, I think, is great. I think we really do need to keep talking.
Yes, I think that's exactly correct. Amongst ourselves, it seems to me there's 6 or 7 main strands of kind of resistance using the law, shall we say, for want of a better term. And I know that when we were sitting around having tea at the Sunrise Celebration with representatives from all sort of 7 of whatever the strands are, we were having a tremendous time together, because really everybody was getting a bit of time to say what they knew, and everybody else was being thoroughly amazed. It's obviously a great way to go forward, and I mean, I think it's really good of you to come on and kind of like remember all of the stuff that you went through. It's a shame we didn't get some of their more revealing stuff on the record, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great shame. It was one of those occasions when it just wasn't going to work, unfortunately. But
I've been wondering about
maybe
this.
Maybe didn't have enough either.
There you go. It's one step at a time, isn't it?
Of course. It has to be said, I'm a relative newcomer to all this stuff. I've only really meaningfully done that one case. I did the other one, which I hardly said anything at. But I think what's really helped me is that I've taken a lot of trouble to go to loads of other people's cases.
Yes.
I've learned a huge amount about how the way those people operate. And it's every time you go, you learn so much. Now, there's an issue that's really started to bug all of us, and that is the courts are restricting the public access. We've had loads of arguments with the security people and with the court managers and everything, so it's something that we're really going to start taking on, I think, in a big way.
I did see that the British Constitution Group were going to start moving a little bit more that way, because obviously if people are going to turn up at court cases, they need to know they're happening, so we need to try and organise some way where people can see that, because...
But the real drag is that people sometimes travel long distances, and then the security won't let them in.
Mm.
And I've started questioning them as to why they're not being allowed in. We had a ridiculous confrontation in Hereford one time.
You did? Where they weren't going to let members of the public in to witness the case?
No, that's right. And in fact, we never did get in. We were saying to these guys, well, isn't this a public building? And they said, yeah. And they said, if you come in, you'll be trespassing. So we were saying, well, how the hell can we trespass in a public building? Absolutely crazy.
Well, one of the things I find quite disturbing about that is the fact that this is how they're basically getting away with stuff in the family courts.
Because
there is just nobody there to witness it. You know, yeah. Well, there is obviously people like Brian Gerrish, and there is now an increasing movement, but by and large, all of that stuff's happening invisibly, and it's obviously working so well there that perhaps they're trying to enforce it elsewhere.
Yeah.
So what sort of moves do you think we can make to get people into the court? Because it, again, it's not their right to stop us.
No. Well, for next Monday, guys been down the court and had big conversations with the managers, and they've actually said that they're going to let a whole bunch of us in.
Okay, but, well, I'll come along.
When we turned up to Birkenhead yesterday, they had a list of names, and my name wasn't on the list, even though I was a witness. And it wasn't until the others arrived, the people whose case it was, that I actually managed to get in at all, in the building.
And who decides who's on the list?
Out in the street until the team turned up.
Who decides who's on the list then, Pete?
Well, I think it's a deliberate policy of exclusion, because when I questioned the security people about whether the public was allowed into any case in the building, they said, well, it all depends on the case, and that was one excuse. The other excuse was that the courts are only small and there isn't room for the public to go in there. Well, but neither of those is a valid explanation, because the public actually has a right to go in, and in fact, if they want to exclude the public, they have to make an application in each and every case.
Yeah, I find this pretty shocking, I must admit. There you go, Hereford's not too far away. If somebody's trying to negotiate it so that people can get in, then I think, don't you, it would be a good idea if some people turned up.
Oh well, I'm going, and I know a few other people are as well.
Yeah.
He has had to push and negotiate it with them, and basically tell them that he wants people let in. He said, look, he said, people are coming from all over the country. I don't even know who they are. They shouldn't have to drive all the way down here, 100 miles or something, and then not be prevented from coming in.
No, indeed, some sort of claim ought to be made if they do have to do that.
Yeah.
And surely, isn't there some possibility for judicial review here? Because surely this is not due process.
It may be. I'm actually thinking of trying to get chapter and verse on it from the law courts in the Strand in London, so that somebody in the system somewhere needs to explain exactly what it is that's going on. Because we were talking yesterday, I remember when I was a kid, loads of people used to go to the public galleries in courts. They used to do it for afternoon's entertainment. And there'd be columns in the newspapers, courts day by day in the Evening Standard. And it was perfectly normal for loads of people to go to courtrooms.
Mm.
Now it seems to have become something that they've deliberately started to restrict.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the things...
I'm pretty sure that we're going to have to stop them doing it.
Mm, yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that's happened, isn't it, is that people have just ceased being interested in what is happening to their fellow man.
Well, yeah.
I think that the Freeman on the Land and the Sovereign Sites and the TPUC and all of that are showing that sort of thing is now changing. There's a bit of a wave running in the other direction.
That's right, yeah. So it's one of those side issues in a way that we're really going to have to get really serious about.
Well, it seems fairly likely that an awful lot of us are going to have a lot more time on our hands in the not-too-distant future, so we can spend it keeping warm in the courts, eh?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've been wondering, in your trips in and out of the courts, I mean, obviously you feel quite strongly about the court managers, and that's been quite a revelation for me, been quite an insight to hear you talk about them. But obviously I'm aware that we're still very much a formative movement, and perhaps with the exception of Birkenhead, not many courts have experienced too many people like us yet. But
no,
are you encountering people in the court service itself who are waking up and who are starting to wonder what they're doing there?
Bit by bit. Some of the biggest hearted people that I've met in the courts are actually the ushers. they often really get what's going on, but of course they're absolutely nothing to do with the system at all. They're ushers, basically. But I've had some really nice conversations with them, and there was one case that I went to in Hereford where the magistrates went out for some reason, that I think there was an adjournment being worked on or something, and we finished up having loads of conversations. There were two coppers in there. The guy got talking to the prosecutor, who it turned out had some big gripes with the electric company that was trying to get an action against him. Mm. And so we had a really good time with him. And the clerk of the court also had a lot of dealings with him as well. So in those intervals in the courts, you can get some really great conversations going, and they're usually very friendly.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people really get what it is that we're trying to say.
Mm. You will be changing minds by doing that. I thought that myself, if that was one of the strengths of the Birkenhead event. I thought, I mean, I was kind of inside, but my helpmate and what have you was outside, and there was a lot of people passing who were asking what was going on. And they could see the way the people in the fluoro jackets were behaving, and they could listen to the arguments of the people that were out there on the, you know, on the pavement. And there was a lot of sympathy. You know, there were some people like that. I think actually in the foyer of the court there were some people who were just some normal, you know, civilian, just some, you know, people sort of tied up in there, and they also were quite interested. And that's another thing, isn't it, that's important. We're not just trying to educate ourselves through this process, but we're trying to educate all of the people that we meet and come across.
Yeah, and just around the corner from the court in Birkenhead, there's I was in the sweet shop there, a paper shop, getting the local papers to see what the coverage was, and the people in there loved what we were doing.
Yeah.
That Asian couple running the shop. And then we were in the pub just up the street from there, real sawdust on the floor pub, and they thought it was absolutely fantastic.
It was fine in the pub afterwards. I enjoyed that a lot. It was. That was very good. Well, that's been really good, Pete. That has. I think you've done sterling effort for us tonight. It's been really helpful. Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, it's really nice to talk about it. It's amazing what comes out when you get talking.
Mm. Well, obviously, you know, there's always space for you on the Dr. Rock radio show. You know, we're always willing to hear what you've got to say.
Well, when something new comes up, I'll definitely go for it.
That'll be very good. Well, in all likelihood, if there's some chance of them letting me in, I'll probably see you in Hereford on Monday.
Yeah, it'll be great. I think it's 10 o'clock, but I'm not sure.
Very good. Well, let me know.
I'll get a bit of info and give you a tinkle.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. And we must, perhaps we can try and work on some, we've mentioned some very, very interesting documents during our discussion. I'd like to try and get them posted up on TNS, but if we work on that together,
yeah,
that'd be really good. In the meantime,
most of them that I've got are actually in Word documents.
Brilliant.
Sometimes the Archbolts cost a fortune to subscribe to, about 600 quid a year or something. So, I've no access to them on the internet. So I actually, the administration of Under Awful Oaths, I actually typed the whole page out.
Yeah.
With all the original fonts and everything. That was real fun.
Well, it would be really great to see them.
You get to know
that other one you mentioned, the Diplock ruling.
Yeah.
It would be good to see that up there as well.
I'll hook up with you and I'll get everything that we've been talking about. I'll get it into a Word document.
Absolutely.
Like I was saying in the interval, I have to get permission from the people that wrote some of it.
Yeah.
To put them up, but I think they'll probably be okay. So I'll anonymise everything and get it to you in Word.
That'll be very good. I'll post it up on TNS and people can have a look at it, and because there's lots of interesting stuff in it.
Yeah.
Well, that's really great. I got a bit of any other business that I'd like to do in the last sort of 10 or 15 minutes, but thank you very much for being my first ever Live-O guest.
Oh, thanks for having me on. It's been great.
I really enjoyed talking to you, and I shall now move over to some Johnny Cash, and I'll speak with you probably a bit after the show, maybe.
Yeah, was it Wanted Man, is it?
Yeah, that's right. When the man comes to town, it's going to be.
Great.
Thanks a lot, Pete. I'll see you soon, mate. Well, very good. Johnny Cash and When the Man Comes to Town. Well, I thought that was an excellent talk from Pete there, really. So much amazing stuff, really. I'm especially interested in the fact that the clerk was not buzzed for when the magistrates disappeared or what have you, and several very strange things, really, that I'm sure that the ballroom dancing team will go and engage with in the future, and hopefully, like we say, we'll hear from it. And you know, what about actually being arrested in the court and put into the dock and then sort of shut in there and having an arrest warrant put on the glass to show you, kind of like, it must have come as a bit of a surprise. And I'm sure that they will rue the day that they chucked Guy and his friend out of their court. I'm sure that there'll be things to be said about that as well. And all of that just to continue with what appeared to be a sort of means inquiry under the guise of an enforcement hearing. It was all just very... The whole thing just gets to look stranger and stranger the harder you look at it. That's all I can say. It really is quite astonishing. So I'm coming to the end of the show now. I'd just like to bring people's attention once more to our intended National Non-Compliance Week between September the 12th and the sort of 18th, when the idea is that instead of roaring around and burning petrol and buying things and paying tax and doing all the stuff that we normally habitually do, that instead of doing that we stack up with all the things that we actually like and want to have about us from local suppliers and from whatever else, rather than from corporations, if at all possible, and we have a bit of a staycation at home. I think it's a really cracking idea. As I said last week, it's not something any of us try very often. I'm certainly going to be giving it a go myself. From my point of view, I wouldn't mind trying to have a bit of a break from the internet and all that sort of stuff as well, and going out into the garden and, I don't know, playing a game of French cricket or something, or maybe meeting up with people down the park and having a picnic, or any one of lots and lots of things. And the thing is, that way we're not only, if there's enough of us, obviously we'll achieve something by kind of impacting the economy. I don't think that really matters. I think it's the impact on the human spirit that's most important. And I think that most of us, if we try doing that sort of thing, we're going to find all sorts of new games to play. And as a result, we'll probably have fewer minutes to play the games that we've been encouraged to play so far, which would be great. Quite fancy the idea of hanging out at home for a while, not driving about, having a look at the place would be really good. Who knows what new ideas we could come up with under those circumstances. On Dr. Rock, or me, Nick M, and Dr. Rock and what have you, we're going to be out on the road again shortly. As you've heard me mentioning, we're going to be going down to the Secret Garden Party, which is somewhere around Cambridge or in Suffolk or something. I'm pretty excited about that. That happens on the 21st, 22nd, 23rd of July, and I already know that there are going to be many, many interesting people down there to talk to and wave my little recording machine at, so hopefully Dr. Rock's radio show will gain some more insights from whoever it is that I run into there. Before that, of course, I'm going to be at Truth Juice Leicester on the 18th of July doing the Sacred Geometry Talk, the newly illustrated one. It's really a pretty fantastic far-out thing now. New software, new illustrations, new models, lots of stuff. Then Truth Juice Birmingham on the 19th. Up there, I really like it there. It's a fantastic place, Truth Juice Birmingham, both of them, in fact. And then on the 20th, there's a kind of joint gig between Truth Juice and the people who are putting on the Wrexham Science Festival. And that's going to be happening in one of the lecture theatres in Wrexham. And, of course, it's a chance for the Truth Juice people to mix it with the normal people of Wrexham, because it's being advertised to every single house, I'm told, in the town. So that should be good for a crack. It's a bit later in the month. In the meantime, anybody who's local to us, we've got the fantastic Factory Theatre Company at the Willow Theatre in Mid Wales, the Living Willow Theatre. If you're interested at all in how Illusion is cast and how the stage works, then in my opinion, the Factory Theatre Company are absolutely the best there are. And they're going to be on there doing a promenade performance of a play called Cymbeline from 6 o'clock. And anybody who's close enough to make it down, it's going to be well worth the £9 you're going to spend, and you'll meet lots of interesting people. So that's about it for me now. I'm going to be shuffling off the airways very shortly. I think Yoda's coming up next with the Financial Frontline, one of my personal favourites on TNS Radio. In the meantime, I'd like to thank you all very much for listening. Thanks to the people that are hosting me. Thanks obviously to Pete coming on and braving the Skype and the microphones and all that sort of stuff. It's, I think, really been a crack, and I look forward to doing a lot more of it in the future. Thanks, of course, to all of you for being there, because without an audience, there isn't a show. I'll see you next week, hopefully, Well, maybe we'll be talking about this permanent court of record. Who knows? Have a good week.